The only thing I know.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare. I would like to open an informational hearing on the Oregon Health Authority update. And who will be first? Let's first let me put on the record that the coordinated care organizations, we will not be discussing that today. We will be discussing that in September, because according to House Bill 2009, there's a statutory requirement to report quarterly, and the health authority is going to be reporting in September. Any questions on that? Okay. Moving on then, one eligibility system and enrollment.
He can't be here until 4.
Okay.
So.
Good afternoon, Chair, Senator Manis Anderson, and committee members. For the records, I am Dr. Varsha Chauhan, the Chief Health Systems Officer for Oregon Health Authority, overseeing the Health System Division, which includes the member services as well. The purpose of my testimony today is provide an update since the last time in February, when I had given an update on how we were doing in the One operations. So, initially, as you know, we are on the path of modernizing the way Oregonians apply for and enroll in OHP by introducing the eligibility system known as One. The goal of One is to simplify the experience for all the Oregonians who are applying for the Oregon Health Plan benefits. Since I provided the update in February, a lot of good work has happened, and there is a lot that we still need to do. But here is an update. The first and most important thing that we have done is working with the community partners to make sure that the One system is accessible to all those who are applying for Oregon Health Plan. So far, the good news is that the One system has met our expectations. In other words, that we have not experienced any major technical problems. Of course, there are enhancements. There are issues that come up once in a while that can be, there are really easy quick fixes, but no big technical issues. The feedback from all our community partners has been very positive, and the input that we receive from our community partners on a weekly basis has really helped us to look into the system, make the enhancements and improvements we need to do to improve the experience of our members. Now we are preparing, at this time, our focus is really on moving to the next step, which is preparing One to be available for all the Oregonians to apply for benefits themselves. And that's what we were, that was the initial plan, and that's where we are heading to. We expect to take this final step, this big step, sometime late in the summer. One of the reasons that we have always taken a graduated approach is because we want to continuously work with our community partners and to test the system. Rather than doing a big bang, is to really learn how the system is going to launch the issues that are with it, fix them so that the impact is not very huge. The other thing that we are trying to be very careful is capacity constraints. As we launch anything new, it always is a learning lesson for us to tell us how we need more capacity or less to address the issues or matters. Again, when I was talking about the capacity, it's the capacity of the staff we have in the member services. So let me share with you some steps we are taking to increase our capacity to improve our process applications, to reduce processing and call waiting times, and also to support all our member services staff. It is really very critical for us not only to focus on the members, but those staff who are doing the work every day, their morale, the structure, they have the resources we provide with them. Since the ACA expansion, which is the Affordable Care Act, OHP now provides coverage to more than a million Oregonians. And because the enrollment process is available year-round, and because the federal regulations require that Medicaid agencies are doing redetermination once every 12 months, our staff is continuously busy. The other side of this is that all the OHP applications, whether it is a member applying for the first time or going through a renewal, each application, each individual, each case is a very unique case. And that's why each case or each application will have a very different processing time. The computer, sometimes we also have some computer issues. We also have issues or downtime with the federal hub. And sometimes it's about the staffing levels as well that impacts our application processing times. In February of this year, we, in order to bring transparency with our stakeholders and to share with not only our community partners, members, stakeholders, we started a monthly webinar. What the monthly webinar does is it shares with all those who are affected by the one system. It gives them a transparent, clear view on what's working, what's not working, what are the challenges, and not only that, what our plan is. We have a stoplight report that tells them these were the issues that were informed through the community partners, these are the issues that we are working on and the timeline, and these are the issues we cannot work. So really transparency with data and impact. You do have with you an updated and FAQ document that's also provided every month after this webinar. We receive questions and get back with answers to those questions in a very timely manner. One of the member services recent focus has been on allocating resources to all the areas so that we can have timely renewal of applications, reduce our call volumes, call wait times. To give you a sense of this work, there is some data in the document presented to you. For example, in February of this month, OHA mailed 52,875 renewal notices to households. Now, these are households, which translates to be around 116,660 individual members. On March 21st, 70,808 individuals received closure notices, and subsequently, 47,718 individuals had their benefits closed on March 31st. That means it translates to 59% of the members who received a renewal notice in Feb renewed their coverage within the applicable timeframes.
Sorry to interrupt. You may be planning on getting to this. Have you guys done any analysis on the 49,000 people or applicants, if you will, who didn't end up renewing even after the closure notices about what those, I mean, why did they, were they not eligible anymore? Were they overwhelmed by life, which happens a lot, and weren't able to renew? Do we know why those 49,000?
Definitely, yes, and we can provide that information to you, Senators.
I'd appreciate it because yes. I think it's an important question because we need to make, you know, churn is a big issue, and if people fall on and off and on and off insurance, that's not going to meet our goals.
Exactly.
In any case, I mean, no matter whether it's commercial or Medicaid, so that would be very helpful. Thank you, Dr.
Sure. And that's that. To add to it, it's really very. And in fact, my background is also of continuously doing a quality improvement and assessing the whys on what's happening, so that we can deploy strategies that can help us overcome any barriers. In addition to this, OHA has also contracted with KPMG, who is a nationwide expert in member services. We have brought them on board not only to work with our systems integrator for one system, Deloitte Consulting, but really to look into what we are doing, how we are doing it, what the gaps are, give us some feedback, share some learning lessons from other states on how they did that, so that we could build a sustainable world-class member services here in Oregon. In July, again, that's a repeat. We are going with the soft launch. We're calling it the soft launch of the One Public implementation. This will allow the members to automatically themselves go in, not automatically. It will allow members to, clients, OHP clients, to directly enroll. During this time of the soft launch, we are expecting that members will have some challenges in providing identification, as it will be a new process for them, will be not able to provide the information that is needed. We are waiting to look at those results so that we could deploy further strategies to make that a seamless process, and hence called the soft launch. OHA also expects that at this time we will have, during that launch, we would have an increased call volume, and we are preparing how we can really staff to capacity to manage those call volumes. Members sometimes are hesitant to provide, and we all know that, are hesitant to provide personal information when they have to use technology, and there would be such similar barriers. And therefore, we will have the other doors still open, which means members can still apply through paper applications or by phone or to the community partners. The final thing that I do want to present here is that we at OHA constantly monitor the processing timelines and strive to address any issues that come up in a timely manner, and of course by updating all the people who are involved, the stakeholders we work with, whether how successful we are or being transparent with our challenges and timelines. The OHP enrollment and renewal update webinars are where OHA shares all these efforts, and the leadership that's me. I lead that webinar myself, and the registration is open to public as well. So we welcome all of you to participate and provide any feedback if you have any, and the link is in the document. With that, if you have any questions for me.
Questions? Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Community Assessment Centers, Karen Hoyler.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Director for Business and Operational Policy with the Health Systems Division at the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm happy to provide an update for you on House Bill 2234, which requires OHA and health plans to reimburse community assessment centers for child abuse, medical assessments, and related services. In a nutshell, this is how OHA is meeting the requirements of HB 2234. Medical services provided by community assessment centers are part of the minimum benefit for both the fee-for-service program and the coordinated care organizations. The conditions of child abuse and related treatments are on line 125 of the prioritized list of health services, and this includes mental health treatments as required by the bill. All of the assessments necessary to confirm or rule out these conditions are covered, including forensic interviews as required by the legislation. House Bill 2234 requires OHA to adopt billing and payment mechanisms to ensure that the reimbursement is proportionate to the scope and intensity of the services provided. Oregon Medicaid rates are proportionate to the scope and intensity of the services provided. This means that the Oregon Medicaid pays a higher rate for services that are more technically challenging, take longer, or require a higher level of training. This is already in place, including services provided by the community assessment centers. In response to a request for guidance from the community assessment centers, OHA published a guide sheet called Billing for Child Abuse, Medical Assessment, and Related Services. And I think you may have this in your packet. And we did that to support the provisions of HB 2234 and answer questions the centers might have. So thank you for that, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or get you further information.
Why don't we have, let's just jump to our 3 o'clock panel, just because some members of OHA's update can't get here till later. So. Go ahead and sit down, and then Doug Riggs, Allison Kelly, Patty Terzian, and Heather Rayburn, if you would come forward.
Doug's just going to make some opening comments, yeah. And then Heather can take his place.
Heather, you can take Doug's place as soon as he says his comments.
Does that make sense?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers, and we very much appreciate the opportunity to provide an update on the implementation of House Bill 2234. As you recall, this bill was enacted on a unanimous basis by this committee and by the House Committee and by the House and Senate last year in response to more than a decade of concerns that reimbursement for community assessment centers mandated under Carley's Law and other Oregon statutes was not being fully implemented. Typically, these centers are lifesavers. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about children who are in at risk, great risk. Our center serves as a partner to law enforcement and the medical community, and their evidence-based models designed to identify and address and coordinate the response to cases of child abuse. House Bill 2234, and I passed out a copy of the first page, which is the operative language, was designed to address one of the three typical services. The first service we offer is medical exams. The second service is a forensic interview, which is a complicated and fairly time-consuming operation. And the third is a follow-up services that we offer and provide in many of our centers. The forensic interview portion exam is designed to gather accurate and truthful information that will hold up in court so we can keep perpetrators away from these vulnerable children. It is very important. It's an evidence-based model that uses a team of experts and prevents the child from being re-traumatized by having to undergo such questioning again and again. Very important. The bill that you passed required the OHA to coordinate a comprehensive review and issuance of clear billing guidelines for payers and for the forensic interviewers. The bill is carefully designed to make sure that something actually happened, something different than what we were doing before. As you may recall, at the first House hearing, prior to the hearing, the OHA told the committee members that no bill was actually necessary. But legislators who looked into this very carefully, including Senator Gelser, Representative Barton, and Representative Wisnett, felt strongly that legislation was necessary and needed. So they opted instead to pass a bill to make it very clear. I'll refer you to the bill itself. Section 2, line 2, has a very important word, and that word is shall. Section 2, subsection 3, has the word ensure. So these are two very carefully crafted words that were designed to make sure that something actually took place and something happened. So the bill states that the Oregon Health Authority shall reimburse a community assessment center for a variety of services. And the third paragraph, or the third bullet, says the authority shall adopt billing and payment mechanisms to ensure that the reimbursement is proportionate to the scope of the cost. To this point, we are not convinced that either of those requirements have been met. This bill was passed 12 months ago, and we're here 12 months later, and Allison and Patty are going to outline some of those issues that we're having. CCOs, which are essentially the agent of the OHA in coordinating and distributing public funds under Medicaid, were supposed to use this guidance in a clear way, understandable way, to pay for these forensic interviews under this new law in compliance with the bill. In our view, the guidance from the OHA has not been clear, and the guidance has left CCOs and insurers confused and either unwilling or uncertain about even discussing a change in billing rates or practices. And Allison and Patty are going to outline those in a moment. A handful of CCOs and insurers have stepped up to the plate, but on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being nothing happening and 10 being something significant happening, I would say we're at a 2.5, if that. This hearing is very important, and we hope we'll send a very clear message to the committee. And the members of this body felt importantly that child abuse has to be addressed, that forensic interviews are a very important instance and important part of that, and need to be taken care of. So we very much appreciate the time today, and I think I'll let Patty outline some of her issues.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Patty Terzian. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers. We serve 21 centers across the state of Oregon. Over 6,500 children are served in our centers every year when there are concerns of abuse. And for centers who have been billing for these services, reimbursements have historically been pretty dismal. About 75% of the kids that we see in our centers are Medicaid covered patients. And for these patients, our centers only receive about 24% back in reimbursement of what's been billed. And when we're billing private insurance providers, it's a little bit better, but centers are still writing off about 46% of the amount that they've billed for those services. House Bill 2234 was aimed to not only improve these rates, but also to, as Doug mentioned, allow us to bill for parts of the child abuse assessment that weren't previously billable. Our centers see kids regardless of their insurance status or their ability to pay, so you can see how it can be especially difficult for us to sustain these services with limited resources. House Bill 2234 requires that private and public health benefit providers reimburse centers for child abuse assessments, including but not limited to the forensic interview, and to ensure that these reimbursements are proportionate to the scope and intensity of the services provided. It was really created to create consistent support to ensure that these services would be available for kids when they need them across the entire state. Unfortunately, as Doug mentioned, a year later, the response has been anything but consistent. We, our office alone with a small staff of three, have spent countless hours scheduling appointments, really trying to take a lead, attending meetings, trying to help OHA and private companies understand the intent of the law and brainstorm different strategies for how it could be implemented, exploring billing codes and different possible rates that would be appropriate, helping individual centers tackle barriers as they arise in their own efforts to obtain better agreements. And centers themselves are reporting a variety of experiences and their own efforts to improve their reimbursement since the bill has passed. We've seen some really great examples of success from some of our CCOs, like Family Care, who's going to speak today, who've really acted as leaders and working with their local center to negotiate better case rates. But in other parts of the state, we have centers who are not hearing back from their CCOs. They can't identify the right person to talk to in their CCO, or they're being told that their CCO won't or can't renegotiate their rates. Some CCOs have seemed confused about the information that OHA sent out, not understanding if they are responsible or if those services need to be billed directly to OHA. Reimbursements of only 24% of the services billed is not proportionate, and it's certainly not sustainable. And sadly, we've really seen no change in this number for most of our centers across the state. Private insurance providers have been willing to work with us as well, but identifying the best codes to use and the appropriate rate for the newly assigned code by OHA has been really challenging. Center leaders need to devote their energy to taking care of the kids in their community. They can't be busy trying to navigate a complex system of medical billing. And what we really need now in order for this bill to be successful is for the Oregon Health Authority to ensure that House Bill 2234 is having the intended impact for centers in the state. And we need more CCOs to be leaders demonstrating successful partnerships with centers and their communities, establishing rates that not only reflect the true cost of these services, but really value and recognize and value the investment in that early intervention and serving these children. Oregon's kids deserve access to these critical services. It's so important that we ensure sustainability of these services by improving our reimbursement rates. It's our hope that House Bill 2234 can still be successfully implemented if we are successful in obtaining strong leadership from our health benefit providers. That really is what it's going to take. We do have some outstanding questions that haven't been answered from OHA, and we would really like for them to just take some leadership in helping us navigate these challenges. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer questions when you're ready to ask them.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Allison Kelly, and I serve as the Chief Executive Officer of Liberty House, which is the Child Abuse Assessment Center serving Marion and Polk counties. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. From the trenches, I can tell you that what we see in our center at Liberty House every week, we serve Marion and Polk counties. We see broken femurs, we see skull fractures, we see other broken bones, we see children who come in who have been sexually abused for years. That's the term that we use, because if we said that they were getting raped night after night after night, it would be too much for us to handle. It's hard for them to handle. We know from science that the lifetime aggregated expense for these children for all of the things that they experience, the guilt, the shame, the fear, the hypervigilance, the inability to focus, as well, thanks to the ACEs study, as the cancer, heart disease, and diabetes, and debilitating depression,
The National Science Foundation in 2013 came out with a study putting the aggregated lifetime expense or cost at over $250,000. So multiplying that by the 1,100 children of confirmed cases in our two counties each year, that's over $275 million. That's not the 11,000 across the state of Oregon. It costs money. And this bill was really about an adequate response. When you bring children into those assessment centers, that's one really important role in stopping the abuse. Most of our centers offer some sort of mental health services, and that's really the key to helping these children get past it, get to a place where that abuse and those traumatic experiences they've had don't hold them back, so that they aren't in the emergency room with all kinds of things later on. So it's really an investment up front. It's a very expensive model. A typical appointment at a child abuse assessment center could be 3 or 4 hours because we take time to go at the child's pace. Our centers don't offer the whole meal deal to every child. There's a lot of triage that goes on up front to make sure that we're only providing the services that they absolutely need, but that we are providing that family support and the ongoing follow-up mental health care. So as a result, centers that are getting reimbursed at 24 to 50 cents on the dollar don't have a sustainable model. And we recently, last week, had a meeting, a statewide meeting of all the directors throughout the state. And we purposefully asked, how's it going in your county? And we had very many, especially our colleagues from the rural areas of the state, describe their inability to make any traction in getting their reimbursement rates approved or increased. And they're at risk. You can't, if you can't pay the bills, then you have to lay off staff. And so really what this is an access issue for children in poor areas, as well as our children up and down the I-5 corridor. Liberty House is one of the largest 4 centers in the state, and we recently went through an expansion. We're on track to serve over 700 children this year, not to mention the additional 200 that get referred under Carley's Law. So we're just asking for some help. We have seen an example, and this is where Heather comes in, of a CCO that just stepped up and said, how can we help? And that's amazing, and that has helped, and that's helped that county. Now what we're hoping for is that we can have a similar experience throughout the rest of the state so that we can help these children. Thank you for listening to me, and I'll turn it over to Heather.
Thank you. Chair Vonna Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, thank you for letting me come and testify today. For the record, my name is Heather Rayburn. I'm the Government Relations Manager with Family Care Health. As you know, we're one of the coordinated care organizations serving the Tri-County area. About 35% of our members, so about 50,000 total, are children under the age of 18. We place a very high priority on early childhood health because we know the impacts that upfront investment pay off in the end. It is unfortunate that any child would ever need an abuse medical assessment, but we do know that some children do, and we want to ensure that those members that need it have the access and that they have access to quality services, particularly with the forensic interviews and exams. We want to make sure that their access and the quality of the services they get does not impede the justice system's ability to do its job later on. So what we did is, before House Bill 2234 ever came before the legislature, we actually dealt with this issue. We were looking at how could we adequately pay and reimburse and reduce administrative difficulty for our providers. And we looked at the system and we said, you know what? Billing this piecemeal, you know, code by code, and there's services that can't otherwise be billed, flat case rate. Let's just do that. Let's just make one rate and it covers everything in the assessment. And so that's what we did starting in January 1st of 2014. Then House Bill 2234 passed in 2015, and our providers came back to us with the language about proportionate reimbursement. And we said, you know what? You're right. And they told us what it costs them to do these assessments. And we said, okay, that's your flat case rate. Because we want to make sure our members get these services. We want them to have access. And for us, it was a really easy decision. We didn't want to negotiate. We didn't want to, you know, go back and forth. We just said, we'll do it. And I would encourage others to look at what we did, look at how it's working for us, and consider something similar. Thank you.
So you're saying that Family Care is reimbursing everybody, correct?
Correct. The providers we have contracted, we are reimbursing a flat case rate, and they told us what they needed to be sustainable, and we said okay.
And you're saying that there are other CCOs that are not reimbursing at all?
Yeah. Or are reimbursing at the exact same rates that they were reimbursing previously before the bill. So not renegotiating those rates, but not providing a higher reimbursement.
Okay. So that's an OHA issue to look at that, and I'm not sure, Karen, if you have a response to why CCOs maybe are not reimbursing like they should.
Can I just ask a question of this panel,
yes.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. So, great, the Family Care is doing this. Okay, props to you guys. The question I would ask is, when your providers have queried the other CCOs or the commercial insurers, because it sounds like they're not doing any better from what I read here, or at least some of them aren't, what's their rationale when you say, look, this is what the legislature expects you to be doing? What do they say to you?
You know, we're not even really getting a response from CCOs. That's our biggest challenge. And so, you know, the network can't negotiate these contracts on behalf of all of our centers. They have to be able to establish those contracts with each of their CCOs. And oftentimes what we're seeing is that our centers are saying, we've sent letters to our CCO, we've called, we don't even know who to talk to, we can't get to the right person. And so, you know, I think that's the biggest issue. We have heard some confusion from CCOs who have said, well, we saw the information that OHA put out, but it looks to us like we're not responsible and that should be billed directly to OHA. So there seems to be some confusion, and we're hoping that OHA can really help educate the CCOs and inform them of both the intent of the law as well as how to implement it.
So quick follow up. Thank you very much. So just to clarify, some of the services are being paid directly by OHA, but others are supposed to be paid, but no, they're all supposed to be paid by the CCOs. I have to say, Madam Chair, I don't know enough of the backstory to figure out whether this would actually be a good idea, but this seems to me, while it's clearly a medical issue, it's really more of a justice issue. It's more of a criminal issue, if you will. And it's unclear to me why this is being considered a medical service. I think this is a forensic service to a large extent. And it seems to me that, frankly, centralizing payment for these services may actually turn out to be a better option, at least for the Medicaid population. I don't know how to think about the commercial population, because it's not as if kids who have commercial insurance are immune to child abuse and neglect. But it seems like this is one of my frustrations. You know, pots of money are considered inviolate, and you can't figure out how to jointly fund something that really should come under lots of people's auspices.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, members of the committee. In response to that, I would say it's both of those things. I would say in the state of Oregon, we have really good public policy around the response to child abuse. ORS 418747 says, you know, look, responding to allegations of child abuse is very complicated. It's never going to be just a law enforcement. It's never going to be just a medical care or an ER visit. It's always going to involve the whole family and concerns about what's going on in that family. How many risk factors are there? How many times has the story about this explanation of this injury changed? It's very complicated. So our public policy in Oregon says work together. That's the multidisciplinary. That's why these centers. The reason that it becomes a healthcare issue is that part of it involves a medical assessment of that child's injuries or the rape, whatever. And that takes very qualified, very highly trained, skilled, experienced, and expensive, if I might add, specialty.
Yeah.
It's a subspecialty in pediatrics. And they have to get it right, you know. And also that, so that's why the combination model. And there is other funding, you know, as you know, for these centers, and that really has helped with some. But when you think about the hours and hours it takes to just bring a child in from the person at the front desk and making call after call to the family and the caseworker and the detective, and then if an appointment gets missed, those kinds of things. So that it's an expensive service model. The diagnostic codes and the CPT codes, those are real codes. They're valid codes because these are medical issues.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know how many of the CCOs who maybe can't afford to go to a higher rate have been subject to the clawback from OHA. Just from the pure perspective that CCOs are supposed to get PMPM and do the best job of health care they can under it, but if they have to keep sending stuff back, it limits their ability to do the job that they were designed to do. No comment necessary.
All right, so, Karen, come on up. And I'm not sure with the CCO quarterly report that's coming out in July 15th, if they're going to be addressing this, if that's part of the, it would be nice to make sure that you're able to respond to the concerns from the assessment centers.
Yeah. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to stay and listen to the whole conversation. Again, Karen Wheeler, Oregon Health Authority. I would say that the CCOs do get a global budget, not commenting on any of their funding, but we do not direct them to pay specific rates. We do have fee-for-service rates that we set, and we do pay those. We enroll providers who deliver any of these kinds of services. We're happy to do even more training and education of this provider type to do that. And I would say that we're also happy to convene groups and maybe get some collective learning. Family care seems to have a good situation, and the providers are happy with that. So we could facilitate a dialogue and get more CCOs involved in that kind of learning.
Thank you. Other comments? All right.
Doug's coming up, simply family care has economies of scale. A lot of the CCOs don't, and that's a real issue as well.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, for the record, Doug Riggs. I just want to make a couple comments. First of all, this was a bill that we put a lot of thought into. This is not my first rodeo around this building or working with the Oregon Health Authority. I've spent the better part of 10 or 15 years working on health reform and CCOs, and I understand that each of them is individual. They try to meet the needs of their community. They're all very busy. They have a lot on their plate. As a result of all of that, we specifically wrote the bill to try to get OHA to take a leadership role. Karen's comments that we don't direct CCOs to do anything was exactly why we put the two words shall and ensure in the bill. We recognize that someone at a central level in the state needed to understand the importance of this particular service. We asked the legislature to codify that in law, which they did, and some one group needs to be much more clear about making that case to the CCOs. I've heard back from CCOs that I've talked to that they were unaware of the bill, they were confused about the bill, they were unclear about the bill. OHA was directed to make sure that they understood what the purpose of the bill was. So I'm all we're asking for today is a leadership role from the Oregon Health Authority recognizing the importance of child abuse, this integrated evidence-based model that we have, and helping work with us to better communicate that to CCOs. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments? All right. Thank you very much. We will now have a report from the Office of Equity and Inclusion's Health Equity Lens, and that is Leanne Johnson.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Leanne Johnson, and I am the director of the Oregon Health Authority Equity and Inclusion Division. Today I'm here to present on a screening tool that the Equity and Inclusion Division has been using to screen legislative concepts and bills to ensure that elements which promote equity, diversity, and inclusion in the state of Oregon are appropriately integrated into bill language and to the intent behind that language. I believe you have a copy in your packet, the actual screening tool. It is entitled the Health Equity and Inclusion Lens for Bill Analysis. We use this one for legislative analysis, and then we also have another slightly modified version that is available for program development. By way of background, this slide shows our current mission and vision statements for the Equity and Inclusion Division. The primary takeaway here is that our role as a division is to work toward the elimination of avoidable health gaps and promote through policy and implementation optimal health outcomes for the people of Oregon. Those health gaps are traditionally referred to as health disparities, and it is important to note that health disparities do not arise by chance, but they result from historical injustice and institutional barriers experienced across various social determinants of health, including education, employment, housing, the environment, transportation, land use, and social inclusion and exclusion. People from socially disadvantaged and historically oppressed communities and populations are disproportionately impacted by health inequities. People most disproportionately impacted include people of color, people with disabilities, tribal peoples, immigrants and refugees, linguistically diverse populations, and people from the LGBTQ communities. In this slide, please see at the bottom of the slide the primary elements of policy that we have worked to integrate at the foundation of our work in the Office of Equity and Inclusion and in the Oregon Health Authority. And please see that as you work up through the blocks, as you worked up through this tiered system, you will see one tiered block entitled Health Equity Policy and Analysis, which is what this focus of this screening tool is about today. Additionally, for the sake of background, it's important to note that the work around equity, diversity, and inclusion is indeed a discipline. And as a discipline, the work in the Equity and Inclusion Division, which addresses health disparities and health inequities, is derived from a practice of strategic development and implementation, which is demonstrated by this slide. There's a growing field of research and knowledge-based and an evidence-based practice involved. The equity, diversity, and inclusion field focuses on the implementation of a variety of strategies. There's an emerging field of research which indicates that the application of these strategies has been proven to move the needle to achieve health equity. Therefore, it is critical to note that these building blocks do translate indeed into action that we are taking as a division, as an agency, and also it does achieve results. So applying the equity and inclusion lens, which is the tool that you should have in front of you, is how we can further implement and deepen the positive impact on policy to address health inequities and the disproportionate impact on the traditionally historically disadvantaged populations in the state of Oregon. So the purpose of the tool is quite simple. We apply the checklist to identify opportunities to strengthen bill language and to better ensure elements which support equity, diversity, and inclusion in policy and legislation is indeed put forward. More specifically, this next slide represents some of the areas for which we are screening through the Equity Lens tool. Community engagement and partnerships. Question, is there an opportunity for us to enhance community engagement and partnerships, and are we specifically naming the communities most disproportionately impacted by health inequities? Real D data collection. Is data collection paramount to this policy or bill, and if so, are we citing the need to collect race, ethnicity, language, and disability demographics per House Bill 2134? Research and evaluation. Has there been an equity impact analysis, or is there opportunity for such? Have we consulted and made decisions based upon health equity and inclusion data and metrics? Health program and services. Are we ensuring culturally responsive services, optimizing the use of traditional health workers? Are we compliant with civil rights and ADA standards? And are we ensuring the use of qualified and certified healthcare interpreters and the appropriate level of language access? And finally, diversity, affirmative action, and discrimination protections. Are we acting upon evidence-based practice and standards regarding diversity and inclusion is a primary question. Are we collecting and acting upon workforce data, following the appropriate affirmative action standards as prescribed by the state and the federal government? What about supplier diversity and the utilization of our Oregon minority women and emerging small business in our contracting? And finally, in OHA, we are working to implement a diversity recruitment policy and procedures, and some of the items in the checklist as it relates to this section reflect that policy in the Oregon Health Authority. I should say that in addition to the opportunity to better integrate health equity and diversity and inclusion practice, we are also screening for any unintended consequence in our bills and in our legislation that might inadvertently be incorporated into the policy or in the bill. For example, bill language is very, perhaps a bill is very explicit about calling out representation of a committee. And in doing so, there may be an assumption that ethnic diversity is implicit in that. However, we have found that if some sectors or populations are explicitly called out and others are not, those which are not could be overlooked. And therefore, explicitly naming the communities that we're trying to involve in these processes, that needs to be very explicit within the bill and not implicit. The next two slides demonstrate an example of application as well as results as it relates to the screening tool. House Bill 3308 was passed in the 2015 session. It directed the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to create a work group of multiple stakeholders to study disparate impact in higher education around underserved populations. With these goals in mind, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission contacted the Equity and Inclusion Division for consultation as it relates to the equity lens. Our division worked with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and applied the equity lens principles for the following results in implementation. Regarding data for culturally specific groups, the opportunity was to work to ensure the collection and the disaggregation of data for culturally specific groups. Disaggregation, as you know, can unmask disparities that are critical as we look at results for our communities. Also, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission was able to better identify key and diverse stakeholders and community groups to participate in and better inform the work group study on disparate outcomes in higher education. Chair Moniz Anderson and members of the committee, this concludes my presentation, and I'd be happy to address any questions at this time.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Lori Koiner to talk about the 1115 waiver.
Good. Thanks.
And Jeremy Vandehey.
This looks familiar. Didn't I just see you guys an hour ago?
I think that you're going to get the same thing twice.
That's good for me. It's an important topic.
We'll make sure the story doesn't change.
Yeah,
okay.
Bates and I are going to keep them in check.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Vandehey, Health Policy Advisor for Governor Brown, and apologies, Sandy, for the surprise.
She said.
wanted to give you a quick update on the waiver, and I know this will be somewhat repetitive. Some of you heard me say this spiel way too many times, I'm sure, by now. We are coming up on the expiration of the 1115 demonstration waiver for the Oregon Health Plan expires next year. Just backing up a little bit, there's basically sort of two documents sort of outline the relationship between the Medicaid program and the state and the federal government. Every state has a state plan, and then states are allowed to sort of color outside of the box through a waiver process, and so that's what we've had. We've had a waiver since the inception of the Oregon Health Plan in 1994, and it expires every 4 or 5 years, and we have to renew it. In 2012, we went through the whole process of designing new Medicaid system through CCOs and health system transformation, and when the state renewed the waiver with the federal government in 2012, they incorporated in the components of CCOs and health system transformation. So the reason why this is important, the reason why I want to make sure you all are up to speed is because we really need to be able to do the renewal and have the renewal to be able to continue on with health system transformation for another 5 years. And that really is the theme of the renewal here. It really is not building something brand new. We aren't tearing down CCOs and starting over with something else. We're 4 years in, and we've learned a lot, and we've put a lot of energy into helping stand this system up. And so the goal here is to be able to continue the momentum and continue health system transformation and be able to take things to the next level. We've had kind of a three-part ask that we've been talking about with CMS about this, and I should back up a little bit. So the normal process is states apply usually about a year in advance, and so we're on that schedule. The timing is sort of awkward because it's it expires 6 months after we'll have a new administration, and so you sort of have to start over conversations sometimes with a brand new set of folks. And so we're pushing to ask CMS to prioritize getting the renewal done this year, and a large part of that is because we aren't coming in with a brand new model of care like several other states are. Washington, Alabama, some others are 3-4 years behind us coming up with their versions of CCOs. We really are looking to lock in the success we've had to date and be able to carry that model forward and continue to push forward and take things to the next level. Some of the areas where we've talked about taking things to the next level and is in the current waiver, continued focused on dual eligibles. That was a large focus when conversations around CCOs first started. It still is a challenge. There's still a number of folks who are dually eligible for Medicare, Medicaid that still remain outside of the coordinated care system. Continuing to support CCOs as they move further upstream and create incentives for them to go further upstream and focus on social determinants of health. And we'll really see a finer point on moving towards more outcomes and equity in particular, identifying where there's disparities and making sure that we aren't leaving anybody behind. And to that end, there's been some issues with tribal health that have come up that we've incorporated into this waiver into some other areas that OHA is working on. So the document itself is online for public comment throughout the month. At the same time, Lori and I have been having conversations with the administration, with CMS, since March, indicating to them that this is a priority for the state to continue the momentum that we've built, to be able to continue CCOs, to be able to take things to the next level. We've held to all of our commitments in the current waiver to hold down costs while at the same time improving quality, improving patient satisfaction, and actually adding nearly 450,000 people to the program into this new model. So we're excited to continue that work and be able to take things to the next level. And Lori's going to talk a little bit more about the details, and she's going to take all the hard questions as well.
Good afternoon, Chairman Sennestin and members of the committee. Yeah, Jeremy summed it up really well, and I think that the points that we have been
– Your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, Lori Quainer. I am Medicaid Director for the Oregon Health Authority. And he summarized really well the points that we've been making in our discussions with CMS. And it's – this has been a very successful model. I think a point that was raised in one of our presentations this morning is that we have saved the federal government lots of dollars, $1.4 billion by the end of the 5 years of this waiver. And our message is that, you know, if we continue the model and continue the good work that the CCOs have been doing, those savings will continue to accrue. We are asking again for a 3.4% sustainable rate of growth, and with global budgets, though in you'll notice in the waiver it's termed an integrated budget.
Right.
Same idea. CCOs will have an integrated budget, and we've also asked one of the key areas where we've learned that we need to do more around language in the waiver is flexible services. So we've taken a fair amount of time to define more specifically flexible services and what we call community benefit. So flexible services are the kinds of services that can be provided to an individual to improve their health, but you wouldn't normally write a medical bill for that. So it might be, for example, mold abatement in a home for a child with asthma or something like that. The community benefit would be investments by CCOs that affect the broader community. So they might be either cooking classes, making sure there's safe places for people to exercise and that sort of thing. Those are together now framed as health-related services, and we are asking CMS to have those counted as part of the medical portion of the rate setting process, and so that does require a waiver. The other areas that we're focusing on, one is continued integration of behavioral, physical, and oral health services. We are going to continue to push those momentum forward, including focus on primary care with patient-centered primary care homes and the Transformation Center. Also, we'll continue with the incentive payment program that's been very successful in moving quality improvement. The third, as Jeremy mentioned, is a focus on improving social determinants of health. We know that that was a real vision in 2012. It's a tough lift, and we believe that we need more time to make that happen. And we have asked for federal financial participation to help build some of the infrastructure around this. The proposal is our pilots that would involve CCOs, but also other entities in their community, such as the local housing authorities, counties, community-based organizations, to prevent homelessness and help with housing supports and services to keep people in housing who are kind of the most vulnerable of our Medicaid clients. And then finally, Jeremy already alluded to a focus on dual eligibles. So, and that would be members who are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. And we have seen that those members, when they're included on their Medicaid side in a CCO, cost less, have more integrated care and coordinated care. And we'd like to, about 50% right now of our dual eligible members are in a CCO, and we'd like to see that number, that proportion go up. So we have, as Jeremy also mentioned, we have public comment period right now. The waiver is posted on our website. We invite public comment. There is a fact sheet and some executive summaries for people who don't want to read the 60-some-odd pages. And we have a survey that is easy to fill out for people who don't have access to a computer. We do have hard copy available both in the Health Services Building and the Portland State Office Building in Portland, where someone can write and request to have a hard copy sent to them. We are accepting comment till June 1st, and we have been, both Jeremy and I and other staff have been out talking about the waiver, receiving comments and feedback from many groups and individuals. I think we've reached over 75 different occasions of discussion of the waiver. We will be responding to all comment and then submitting our final application by mid-June. Next steps after that, we have been in conversations with CMS to ensure that we can have the waiver, at least the major policy portions, agreed upon with CMS by late fall, and then we'll be the renewal would start next June 2017. So any questions? And also, I didn't go through the slides. They're in your handout. They say most of what I've said, so you can refer to them later.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. I knew we were under time pressure this morning. I knew it here this afternoon, so I'm asking now instead of this morning. Can you give us some examples of some of the kinds of feedback you've gotten, Ms. Coyner, about things that people would like to see in the waiver that aren't, things that people are worried are in the waiver that they think shouldn't be? What are you hearing?
Chairman Sanderson and Senator Steiner Hayward, we've heard all sorts of things, so let me give a couple examples. We've met numerous times with tribal governments, and it became apparent that there were issues that they were experiencing around obtaining specialty care services. We have made some changes to the waiver related to that, along with other avenues for addressing those issues. So, you know, we've incorporated language. The other piece that they requested was our community health partner, or coordinated health partnerships. Right now, the lead entity is designed to be a CCO, and we had anticipated we'd have up to 16, you know, pilots. We've also added language that a tribal government or a collection of tribal governments also could be a lead entity for a coordinated health partnership. So that would be an example. I can give some more if you'd like.
It's a good place to start. Thank you, and I'm glad to hear that you're working so closely with the tribal governments, because they do have unique health issues that we need to be addressing.
Thank you.
Just right along those lines, there have been a number of issues that have been brought to my attention that I've already shared with Jeremy, such as expanding substance abuse services integration, and I know you already have a work group on that, but because we have public comment coming, hopefully the people who brought these issues forward will make sure that they put that down. The other is, of course, housing, the coordinated health partnerships, and I think everybody's working on that, but is that going to be a part of the waiver or not?
Senator Monis-Anderson, yes, housing is an important part of the coordinated health partnerships, and I did present to, actually Jeremy and I presented to the Association of Counties, for example, and got feedback from them because they would be entities that would be involved in these health partnerships. We've actually received quite positive feedback around the housing pilots that we're proposing, and that's really where we think that we need added federal financial participation to build the infrastructure for our CCOs to work with corrections, the state hospital, housing authorities, hospitals, you know, and a lot broader array of organizations.
That's right. The care coordination among the state hospital, those that are discharged from the state hospital, and the incarcerated individuals is a real important area. And then sort of my favorite, the doulas and traditional health workers. I know because there's like about 30 or 40 doula train people who are being trained to be doulas. Actually, in my church, they come every week. But regarding the waiver, how will that?
Senator Monis-Anderson, we have a
supervision part too.
Yeah, we have a specific ask that doulas would be able to practice without having direct supervision by a physician or a advanced nurse practitioner. And so that's part of the waiver. We also have language in the waiver around traditional health workers and continuing to expand that workforce.
Great. And Chair Monis-Anderson, if I could just add real quick on the coordinated health partnerships piece. So I think, you know, really the idea there is there's some sort of hard stops between systems where, you know, CCOs aren't allowed to pay for services in jail. Jail isn't allowed to pay for services under the CCO. Similarly, if somebody's going in and out of the state hospital, the idea really is to build off of a recent waiver that was approved in California, appearing to be loosening some of the restrictions at the federal level through guidance the last couple years, to be able to kind of push a little bit farther, provide a little bit more flexibility for CCOs and communities to come together to ease those transitions and try to not have people fall between the cracks as they're transitioning between those different systems. So we are to answer your question about, is it going to make it in? I think Lori's had some really positive conversations with CMS. We are asking them to push a little bit farther beyond where they've gone to date. But we're sort of saying in return, we will we'll test these models, we'll track the performance, and see if we're getting the outcomes that we suspect we'll get by ensuring people have stable housing and better transitions between systems.
And CMS evidently doesn't like the word global budget. They like the term integrated.
Yeah, there was a little bit of confusion today around the term global budget was not included in the narrative. There was no intent, I don't think, by anybody to move away from the global budget concept. So I think that can be clarified. But no, the waiver would
still going to have a global budget.
The global budget concept, exactly.
Right. Prisons now
looks like it's starting to.
Any other questions? Yeah, Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, first off, thank you for allowing me to come here today. I do appreciate it, and I mainly came for this discussion. We heard it this morning, and you stuck to the right script. You didn't change anything on us. I appreciate that. When this waiver started out, many of us were really quite concerned about it. The request I didn't think was strong enough and didn't have enough in it. It's vastly improved from where it was a couple of months ago, and we do appreciate that. We also appreciate keeping the legislature deeply involved. I think it helps us all to have that kind of interaction. As far as getting this done by the fall, I think it's going to be a challenge, but it's probably a good one. I've talked to our congressional delegation. They agree with you, as I said this morning. If you can get it done before the new administration comes in, it's a big plus, because it could be a year after that before you can get anything else done again. So it's good if we can get through, but don't give up the farm just to get the waiver. We make sure we hold our ground. I'm still concerned, even if all the things, good things you've done in this, getting flexible services below the MLR, below the 85%, trying to exclude high-cost drugs and other things we have no control over, the feds do. That's all great stuff. And it's really reassuring to me, but I am still going to hammer you on one thing, and you know what it is, that's shared savings. The federal government has saved billions of dollars because of the Oregon Health Plan, and they're really not willing to have those shared savings with the way this waiver is written now. And I'm going to ask again here and ask for a response that we have that conversation with them as part of the waiver. You know, we know how much we've saved. We know what it costs other states to run these programs. 5-7% per member per month increases. We're at 3.4. We're going to go there again for 5 years. We need to share those savings. Otherwise, there's no real incentive for us for doing it this way. We're doing the right thing. We're doing global budgets, as the chair just said. I don't see global budget hardly anywhere in here, and it should be. And we should be playing hardball with these guys. It's like they're playing hardball with us. I think there's lots of support for your congressional delegation to help you out, too. So I'm asking you to think about getting that in the waiver as part of the discussion.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Bates, thank you, first of all, for the good comments and support. I'm glad that we didn't feel like we've been keeping you up to speed. It's great. I think there's sort of three balls in the air as I see them. One is timing. One is shared savings or additional financial participation. And the third is sort of the new things that we're proposing. And so I think we're understanding and being realistic that CMS has its own list of priorities of things that they're trying to get done this year. We are advocating very strongly and are going to continue, I think, and really have a good sense in the next few weeks to a month of where we're at. But at this point, we aren't backing down of any off of those three. But I think you raise a really good point about not giving away the farm, and we'll sort of have to adjust as we get through the process. But I do want to reiterate that CMS has made it very clear that they're supportive of the model, that there's no indication that they want to back away. It's just sort of a matter of timing on their end. They have a different view, I think, of the shared savings. But I think you raised some good points, and you're a great advocate, so we might pull you in if we need you to help share that story.
Anytime. But they want a great program. They still want to take part in paying for it.
Senator Cruz.
First of all, the CMS can say one thing today and an entirely different thing tomorrow. We know that for an absolute fact. We've tried to get incredibly clever around Medicaid services all around our prison. And if California is actually getting some dollars, I think we should be okay.
Hello.
I can shut down a room.
There you go, Ms. Darby.
If indeed California is getting some Medicaid services into their correctional facilities, I think we ought to absolutely mirror that. It's going to be tough budget times, and if we can get some federal dollars in there, that would be very helpful. I think Colette Peters would probably appreciate it.
Yes. I don't mean to pile on to you two because you're doing yeoman's work here, but I just want to add on to what the senator is saying, and it kind of refers back, if you were in the room, to when I was saying that I get frustrated by the fact that all these pots of money are kept separately, right? And I know that it's the feds, and I know that they don't see the world this way, but the reality is that if they were doing a little bit more on the shared savings stuff, we would be asking them, for example, for less money for housing, because we would get these people into housing, we would do them stably the way you're talking about, and ultimately, we get them better educated, and they become tax-paying citizens. And that's a good thing, right? Instead of being incarcerated or
you know, receiving a wide range of human services that make them not have the dignity they deserve, make them not the productive members. I'm ranting a little bit, but I think those are the conversations we need to be having with our federal partners, that we can put, we have a demonstrated track record in the state of putting money that the feds give us to good use in ways that benefit Oregon and benefit the country. I think we should be given the opportunity to do that. I recognize the feds have budget issues too. Everybody's got budget issues. But they get a pretty good bang for their buck from us. And I think they need to understand that we're saving them money not just on health care and not just now, but 50 years from now. But we can also save them money by not having people on services, by having people who are taxpayers, you know. They've got to understand that this healthcare stuff does not exist in a vacuum. You're doing a good job of making that clear, but I think we need to make it even clearer, and I think it's an argument toward what Senator Bates said.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Sander here, we couldn't agree with you more, and I think it's actually really amazing to me that 4 years later we're even having these conversations around how is the healthcare system going to move further into social determinants. And so that's, I think that's really what we've been trying to illustrate to CMS when we tell them that how critical it is that they maintain the momentum that we've built, that we've got folks around the table that haven't ever been around the table together working. So to appreciate those comments.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oral Health in Oregon report, Dr. Bruce Austin.
I'm Bruce Austin, the statewide dental director in the Oregon Health Authority. Chair Monica Sanderson, members of the committee, thanks very much for having me present to you today. And also thank you for sponsoring Senate Bill 672 in the last session, which created this position and my position. I do believe that the decision by the legislature to establish in statute the position of dental director reflects an understanding that oral health is important and inseparable from overall health, and it shows a commitment to deliver better care, better health, and lower costs for all Oregonians of all ages and backgrounds. Senate Bill 672 directs me to, and I'm quoting here, provide recommendations and guidance to the authority and other state agencies, individuals, and community providers on how to prevent oral diseases and measures to take to improve, promote, and protect the oral health of the residents of this state, with a focus on reducing oral health disparities among underserved populations. Another requirement was that I submit a report to the legislature by March 15 of this year, and I think you've been given copies of that. I would like today to present briefly what I believe are some of the highlights from my report, and then I welcome any questions. As a background, oral diseases affect what we eat, how we communicate, the way we look, our ability to learn, and how we feel about ourselves. Despite being a preventable disease, tooth decay is the most common chronic disease affecting U.S. children and teens, with rates up to 4 times higher than asthma. Having a healthy mouth is an important part of overall health and is especially important to child development. The burden of early childhood decay is a significant public health concern and causes needless pain and suffering for many children. Poor oral health among children affects speech, nutrition, growth, social development, and the ability to learn. In adults, dental disease, primarily tooth decay and gum disease, has been linked to significant increases in incidence and severity of diabetes, heart disease, and it causes worse pregnancy outcomes. For example, 6 out of 7 pregnant women with gum disease will have premature births or low birth weight babies, and that affects these children for life. Dental problems don't only impact health, but behavioral health as well, including lower self-image, anxiety, and lower employability. In a new study, which will be published 2 weeks from now, a nationwide survey shows that Oregon ranks near the top, 41%, in numbers of low-income adults who reported that the appearance of their mouth and teeth affects their ability to interview for a job. In the same survey, 48%, almost half of low-income adults in Oregon, avoid smiling due to the condition of their mouth and teeth. So that's an argument for oral health is not just oral health. It crosses the spectrum to behavioral health and overall health. The Public Health Division's most recent SMILE survey, which was 2012, we do this every 5 years, showed that on any given day in Oregon, up to 3,800 children in first to third grades are suffering from pain or oral infections, and these are kids that can't learn or play or interact like they should. Children with poor oral health have worse academic performance and are nearly three times more likely to miss school as a result of dental pain. Rampant decay is defined as having seven or more cavities, and in this 2012 study, 14% of our 6 to 9 year olds, approximately 17,000 kids in Oregon, had rampant decay, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a few minutes. Most dental problems in children and adults are preventable. If people forego dental treatment or don't have access or coverage for dental care, many of them seek treatment for dental emergencies in hospital emergency departments, a very costly and inefficient source of dental care. A 2010 study estimated that the cost associated with non-traumatic dental problems in Oregon's emergency departments was $8 million that year. We have disparities in oral health in Oregon. Again, from the 2012 SMILE survey, Black, multiracial, and rural Oregonians receive dental care at rates well below the state average, as do Oregonians at lower income and education levels. Accordingly, rates of tooth decay and gum disease are much higher in these populations. So we have some challenges in Oregon's oral health care, but we're doing some exciting things in my position and in the OHA to begin to make improvements. And my role is to work across the OHA, coordinating oral health work to be done in the divisions of health services, public health, and health policy and analytics. This has allowed for better coordination and strategic planning throughout the agency and further integrates oral health with physical and behavioral health delivery system transformation efforts. In my first year in my new role, my priorities were stakeholder engagement, assessing current oral health issues and needs in Oregon, and identifying improvement targets and establishing plans to address these challenges. Much of my time was spent with outreach meetings and education to OHA and non-OHA groups and individuals, including a presentation to the Oregon Health Policy Board, which was their first presentation on oral health. We created cross-divisional work groups to increase awareness and elevate oral health issues. We created rules and systems to carry out the oral health work done by the 2015 legislature, including a new certification program for school-based sealant programs, dental screenings for new elementary students, and oral health training for traditional health workers. We approved our first two dental pilot projects late in 2015, as allowed by Senate Bill 738 from 2011. And you'll hear more about this program around 4 o'clock today. These pilot projects aim to find novel approaches to dental workforce issues in the state. The Public Health Division released the State Health Improvement Plan in late 2015. Of the seven priority areas, one is to improve oral health. There are many goals on our SHIP Oral Health Work Plan, and the only population-based goal is to increase the percentage of Oregonians with access to optimally fluoridated water supplies. The Centers for Disease Control recognized two, and they only mentioned two measures here, interventions for reducing dental decay in a community. One is the school-based sealant programs, which we're doing very well, and the other is community water fluoridation. In this
I think it was on the ballot somewhere in the
Newport.
In Newport, and it failed.
Yes. I'll talk more about that in a minute. Thank you. In this current school year, our school-based sealant programs will serve 72% of all eligible schools, which is 506 schools across the state this year, and our program is ranked in the top three of all the states. As far as water fluoridation, Oregon currently ranks 48th among the states for percentage of residents with access to fluoridated public water supplies. Oregon is at 23%, and the national average is 75%. For every $1 spent on fluoridation, an average of $38 is saved in dental treatment costs per person per year. Even with all the other forms of fluoride out there, such as toothpaste, rinses, tablets, varnish, water fluoridation reduces caries by an average of another 25%. One of the biggest effects of water fluoridation is to greatly decrease the number of kids with rampant caries, which I explained is a large number in Oregon. Many of these kids end up having general anesthesia to treat their decay. This is expensive, and emerging research shows worrisome side effects of general anesthesia on developing brains. Water fluoridation is the most cost-effective, safe, and equitable way to reduce dental decay across a population, across the lifespan, and regardless of geography, income, or race and ethnicity. The goal in the SHIP is to increase our 23% to a goal of 80% by 2019. And if you know anything about the history of water fluoridation in Oregon, you'll see that this is quite a challenging goal, and I think Senator Steiner Hayward and I have some similar passions and frustrations. We're we're right in the midst of forming a work group to look into our long-term plan for this, and we may need your help along the way. We have some new staff members devoted to oral health within the OHA. We have two consultant-led projects just beginning. One of those is looking at the integration of oral health in Oregon and the strategy of oral health within the OHA. So we're expanding in some exciting ways. In 2018, we'll begin our 2017 SMILE survey. We're looking at more ways to integrate oral health into telehealth. We'll hear more about that later this afternoon. We will develop an OHA plan for oral health, and we'll focus on defining and implementing even more efficient integration of oral health into the overall system. We're also learning more about available data and data that we may need to better understand access to dental care in the state. In the past year, I've seen an obvious increased awareness of the importance of oral health within OHA leadership and staff, as well as outside stakeholders. A recent example of this was that our director, Lynn Saxton, gave the keynote address at a gathering of groups who were awarded grants by the Oregon Community Foundation's Children's Health Initiative, where she demonstrated her commitment and the commitment of OHA to improving oral health. I also very much appreciated seeing you there, Senator Mona Sanderson.
It was nice, very good. And I actually, well, Dr. Bates left, met some wonderful people working in oral health throughout the state at that conference.
Yeah, your support was widely noticed there. Thank you. I very much appreciate the legislature's creation of a dental director position and the support of oral health and overall health for Oregonians. Improved oral health and oral health integration within CCOs is a key step to bringing better health, better care, and lower costs to all Oregonians. It's been my distinct honor to serve in this role, and I look forward to working with you and all stakeholders to implement these goals and contribute to the health of Oregonians. Thank you very much, and I'd be glad to take any questions.
Well, welcome aboard. It's great to
have
you. Any questions?
I'm just going to brag 15 seconds. My bill. I mean, 2 years in a row, we worked on that, but gained the dental director, and this is exactly why. And it's because of exactly the points that he made. You know, Dr. Bates and I have both mentioned this multiple times. I can't control someone's diabetes if they have poor oral health. We can't prevent preterm delivery if people have poor oral health. We can't keep kids in school if they don't have good oral health. And without somebody really focused on this, and willing to work in terms of system integration, we're not going to be able to do it. So thank you, Dr. Austin. It's a pleasure having you here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. With that, thank you very much. And we'll have an update on the health insurance marketplace and RFP recommendations. Pat Allen and Barry Leslie. Yeah. Come on down.
I can see it. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm joined today by Barry Leslie, who's the administrator of the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace, and we're here to spend a few minutes talking to you about a recent request for proposals we did for a health insurance marketplace platform. And our analysis and conclusions about that. A logical question is, why in the heck would we be looking at building our own platform, having just come off of a fairly difficult experience with Cover Oregon and its well-known troubles? A couple of reasons for that. First, the federal government has been allowing us to use their platform for free up until this point for the last 2 years of open enrollment. They're going to begin charging us for that. Ultimately, they'll be charging 3% of premium, which is a fairly significant amount, although in the first year that'll be a percent and a half of premium as we ramp up into that. And so as we look at that cost to Oregon insurers and thus Oregon ratepayers, we thought it was reasonable to want to compare that to what to what we would pay if we were not dependent on the federal platform. The other reason is in terms of what you get or don't get when you run your own platform, there's a huge degree of control and policy flexibility that you have when you have a platform that you don't have if you're dependent on federal technology. Let me give you one simple example. Last session, you all passed a bill to provide a premium support program for Compacted Free Association Islanders who are in the United States who aren't qualified for Medicaid, but you were interested in providing them the ability to get Medicaid-like health insurance benefits. We're going to deliver that program with sort of a workaround to be able to deliver that. If you have a platform, you're able to do that much more directly.
Madam Chair, before you go, 3% doesn't tell me anything. How much a year are we talking?
It's about $15 million. $15 million per year for the federal platform charge.
That would be the 3%. Okay.
Right. Now that number is, I say that number with a great deal of certainty. That's dependent. It's 3% of the rates that are charged. So it's dependent on what are the rates at the time that they begin implementing that, and rates change over time. It's also dependent on how many people have signed up for health care, and we're increasing the number of people who sign up for health care. So when I say $15 million, there are some assumptions that are baked into that around rates and around enrollment.
Okay. Even if we assume $20 million, I'm trying to figure out how many years to get up to the amount of money we spent on Cover Oregon, but that's another discussion.
Different math problem, to be sure. The last thing in terms of why now is that until very recently, we were required to begin rolling out a small business health insurance platform called SHOP. Federal government has actually just given us two more years before we have to deliver that product. SHOP is an exchange that small business employees can use to have access to choice of coverage, and that's a whole separate policy discussion we can get into if you'd like. So really what there are two options. One is to stay on the federal platform with some of the inherent shortcomings that go with that. The other is to pick a vendor product. And the biggest difference I need to point out between doing a vendor product now and doing one 4 or 5 years ago is that there's now actually a somewhat mature vendor market of providers of platforms that are up and running in a variety of states. And so you're no longer talking about going out to the marketplace and having a software company build you something that doesn't exist. You're talking about buying something that exists and is in use and can be demonstrated, and you can see it and touch it and feel it and make sure it works and all those kinds of things. So it's really a very different environment for that. So we did a request for proposals to the vendor market, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Leslie to have her talk a little bit about that process.
Good afternoon. As Pat said, I'm Barry Leslie, the administrator for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace. So we put out a request for proposal a few months ago and received back four bids, three of whom qualified, meaning that important minimum requirement that they're successfully operating in another state. So what we did is we took the information that we got back from the vendor community and put together a pretty robust analysis comparing the continued use of healthcare.gov with going with one of these three private vendor options. And we put together this analysis for all of you and also for the Health Insurance Advisory Committee that had a chance to talk about this issue at the last committee meeting. In the analysis, we really broke down the analysis into four main parts. The first is functionality. And so what do you get or give for using healthcare.gov or going with a private vendor solution? Really, either option provides the same functionality. Healthcare.gov has been successfully working for the last couple of years, and these private vendor solutions have been successfully working in other states. So really, that's kind of an even across-the-board look if you're evaluating the two. In terms of cost, what we came away with is that a private vendor solution would be about $3 million more per year than continuing with healthcare.gov, so that makes the cost portion of that analysis easier. When we were comparing program impacts, the biggest distinction is that to continue with healthcare.gov, that keeps our operational level at the state kind of status quo, whereas if we were to go with a private vendor solution, we would need to staff up for that, because healthcare.gov currently takes care of everything related to enrollment and eligibility, of which technology is a part. If we were to take on those functions, we would obviously need to add significant FTE to our existing infrastructure. In terms of consumer impacts, consumers have been using healthcare.gov for the last couple of years, and so they're comfortable with it. It's certainly not perfect, but there is the risk of switching systems and losing some credibility with consumers, and perhaps losing consumers themselves because they're frustrated with having to switch and can't just re-enroll like they can with healthcare.gov. So those are some of the considerations the committee looked at when they were analyzing the two options.
So we've talked about the advisory committee. This is the advisory committee that was created in Senate Bill 1 that transferred the functions of the health insurance marketplace to DCBS. It's 13 members drawn from a wide variety of perspectives, providers, carriers, customer of the insurance marketplace, community organizations, those kinds of things. This was actually their second full meeting that we brought them this body of work, and they actually did yeoman's work studying, getting into the material, really understanding it, and had a very robust discussion about this. And they really broke out into kind of three categories. The one group of them said, absolutely, by God, we should go ahead and move forward with doing our own platform because of the various program advantages that we get by being able to control our own destiny. Another group of them said, no way, no how should we do a platform. It's a distraction from the task at hand, which is getting people signed up for health insurance and getting as much coverage as we can. And a third group said, we probably at some point should have our own platform, but today is not that day, and we don't think you should move forward. And that really is essentially what our recommendation is, and I want to talk about that for just a minute. If we were sitting today without CoverOregon ever having happened, and what I was telling you was for $3 million a year more than what we would pay the federal government, we could have a system that does all the things that we might want to tailor it to do in Oregon, and we would have control over our own decision-making and those kinds of things, that $3 million or 6-7% per year would not be a big enough difference to say, well, no, that's just not worth it. But the history we have is the history that we've had, and we do think it would be a distraction from the task at hand to try to dive into a project like that. Also, the vendor market is not quite as mature as we had hoped at this stage, and we think in a period of time in the future it will be better. Senator Steiner Hayward has a
proposal. Answered my question.
Okay.
Thank you.
But what I do want to be clear about is there are some trade-offs inherent in this, and it's important for us that you understand that. Senator Steiner Hayward has asked me previously, is it true that not doing our own platform means we can't do the basic health plan, for example, which is something that we've been tasked with studying right now? And the answer to that is no, but our ability to do anything that's tailored is going to require some sort of workaround if it's not something that the federal healthcare.gov platform can do for us. Now, that doesn't mean it's impossible. It might mean it's a little more difficult. It might mean it's a little more expensive. And as you look at a range of those things, there are some of them for which the difficulty or expense might be enough for you to say, yeah, you know, it's a good idea, but it's not that great an idea, and it might not be worth doing. I think on balance, we'll probably do fewer of those kinds of things in Oregon being dependent on healthcare.gov than we would if we had our own platform. But that's a very fine distinction. Things like the basic health plan have much more fundamental questions to answer before you ever get to a platform question as the issue that you get to there.
I'm not really comfortable with the 3 to 5 years. I think you should be taking an annual look. Quite honestly, where we're at now, we'll never, with healthcare.gov, we're never going to get to what we were promised initially, which was a true marketplace. And to do that, it's going to have to be something other than what the feds are doing. And so the 3 to 5 years is not a comfort level with me. Technology moves fast, and you're assuming it's going to take that long for somebody to perfect the platform. I think you need an annual look at this thing.
Yeah, Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, fair enough. I think that what we will in fact be doing is closely and more or less continuously monitoring what's going on in the marketplace. This is more the timeline of that we would go out and do a full-blown RFP and a full-blown financial analysis again. I don't think the industry would respond to us if we put out an RFP every year just to kind of check and see.
I understand, but just monitor what's happening in the universe.
Yes,
so,
yeah. I agree.
Senator Knope.
Thank you. Director Allen, I had two or three questions from the from your memo here, and one of them I didn't see necessarily addressed, but I sped read it. right?
Okay.
So, the reserve fund. Mm-hmm. There is a reserve fund. I don't know how much is in it. So where is that going to go if we move to the feds?
Sure. Chairman Sanderson, Senator Knope, the reserve fund is capped by statute, and we've got a procedure and administrative rule for how we assess the adequacy of the fund and then provide rebates back to the carriers that that paid it. And so we'll go through that process in the ordinary course. And by not doing a project, we won't have a claim on that reserve fund, so it would increase the amount that's rebated.
Okay. Follow up? So somewhere in there, I think I read something about you're going to try to get to back to $6 per member per month in 2017. Did I read that right?
That's correct. We've filed a rule for the assessment for the coming year, 2017, which is a $6 per member per month assessment on medical policies.
Okay, and where are we at now?
About $9.66.
Okay. And the other thing that caught my eye in here was the addition of 80 employees. And I just wondered how that might compare to other states of our size that have done this already.
That's the call center. You want to speak to that?
Sure, yeah. Chairman Sanderson, Senator Knope, thank you for the question. We actually talked to Washington and Colorado a couple of other states that currently have their own systems, and that is what they told us. If they didn't actually hire out their call center, use a private vendor to do their call center functionality, that's about what they told us that they would be increased. That's about what they told us they had in terms of eligibility and enrollment staff. It's also what Cover Oregon had basically in terms of their eligibility enrollment call center.
So they used a private call center, but we would hire employees internally. Is there a reason for that?
Go ahead.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Knope, I have not, in the states that I have spoken to who have private vendor call centers, have not had good experiences in terms of the service to their constituencies. And I think one of the real values and one of the really important things that I've heard from folks is that they really want Oregonians to really have that extra care that goes into working with a neighbor or someone who's a trusted partner. And they did that, this level of service just hasn't existed from the anecdotal evidence I've heard from other states in the call center community.
And just to be clear, keep in mind, this is these are the details to implement the path that we're choosing not to follow.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Bates.
Thank you. I'm not really part of this committee, but thank you. A couple other issues. I got called out a couple of times. I want to make sure you cover those. I'm going to ask you the question about them. The basis of this program is really to work with the IRS and the rebates people get against their cost and how those are applied. And we have all kinds of problems of people dropping off the cliff at 400% and other things. We got an election coming up in November. And when I think about those things and what's going on in the system and $5,000 and $10,000 deductible for patients and people just screaming mad about it, I'm not sure this program is going to be here in 3 to 5 years. So your idea of staying with the technology you have that works and waiting over the next year and a half to see if the system even is there in 2.5 to 5 years, I think is important. We may not be looking at this system at all in the future. We may say it's a failed system or the court says you can't give that rebate. There's all kinds of issues out there.
I agree. If I could just make one comment. I talked about focusing on the task at hand. You hit, I think, one of the biggest ones, which is working to get people into the right plan. We have an awful lot of people, and we and I have talked about this, that are out there picking up bronze plan because it's got the cheapest list price, when in fact they're big users of healthcare, and what they need to get into is a silver plan that's got cost sharing components and drives down those deductibles and copays and those kinds of things. And that's the stuff that we really want to focus on, is how to get consumers educated about how to make the best choice for the plan that they need to buy.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you.
Are you fine? Finished?
No, I am done. Okay.
I just want to be sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to thank both of you for a very nuanced presentation on this issue, and I think that's really important. And too often we hear sort of black and white, this is what we should be doing. You've pointed out, both of you, the advantages and disadvantages of going both routes, and that your decision was very considered. The one request I would make is that in addition to keeping an eye on the marketplace, in addition to thinking about going out for an RFP, is that you figure out a way to track the costs of what we're not doing,
or the costs.
So you pointed out, for example, that you had to do a workaround for the COFA population, which was something that was universally supported in this legislature, or just about universally supported. How much did that cost us compared to what we could have done if we'd had our own system? If the state does choose to go forward, I mean, I agree. There's a gazillion other things to think about with a basic health plan besides the cost of doing it when we can't do it on, you know, healthcare.gov. But I'd like to know how much that would cost us. And what would it save the state in other ways if we did have a, you know what I'm saying? I understand these economic analyses are tough. I get that. I'm not asking you to devote enormous amounts of time and energy to it, but I would like to have some sense about costs that we are or are not incurring by making this decision and keeping with it for the next 3 to 5 years, because I think that down the road it will help us think, if, as Senator Bates said, you know, healthcare.gov goes away, or if there's a new system, or if whatever, it'll help us make our decision in 2019.
That's a great point. We absolutely can do that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Any other discussion? Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
All right. I want to know if Pam Johnson and Sarah Rogers are here regarding the tribal. Okay, so let's do the presentation on Medicaid adherence, and hopefully then it'll be 4 o'clock, and we will then be able to go forward with the dental workforce pilot programs.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee. My name is Joel White. I am pleased to be here today to talk to you about medication adherence and to tell you a little bit about some exciting developments in efforts to improve health outcomes and lower health care costs. I want to tell you a little bit about my organization, Prescriptions for a Healthy America. We are a multifaceted advocacy stakeholder organization in Washington, D.C., who came together 4 years ago to really focus on how to improve America's health by improving outcomes and lowering costs through medication adherence. And I think if you take a look at some of the members in the presentation here, we are patient and consumer groups and big businesses. We are generic manufacturers and brand manufacturers. We are retail pharmacists and big chain drug stores and PBMs. Essentially, across the healthcare spectrum, we are the stakeholders who typically are in opposition to one another, but who came together around the issue of medication adherence because we saw it as an opportunity to lower costs and improve health outcomes. We asked ourselves a question 4 years ago, why medication adherence? And I think after some soul searching, we came up with a few facts. The first was that the United States continues to spend more and more on healthcare, currently at 18% of GDP. That led to tightening budgets both at the federal and state levels, and that what we really wanted to do was figure out a way to save healthcare dollars by improving health outcomes. And we settled on the issue of medication adherence. And I can tell you from my perspective, my background in health policy over the last 25 years, I have rarely come across an issue such as this where you can literally wear a white hat and do these good things to improve outcomes and lower costs. So we began wrestling with the issue. I think just level setting on some facts is important. First of all, about two-thirds of all patients don't take their medications as prescribed. About 1 in 5 new medications goes unfilled. And this disproportionately impacts those with chronic illnesses, those who take medications on a more regular basis. And so in terms of the human costs, that translates into about $213 billion in avoidable expenses, 10 million hospital admissions, 78 million outpatient visits, 246 million inappropriate prescriptions, and 4 million emergency room visits. But I think the real toll here that we should pay attention to is about 125,000 avoidable deaths every year as a result of poor medication adherence. Put another way, we can look at the dollar factors from non-adherence, about $105 billion every year in non-adherence costs, medication errors of about $21 billion, and $87 billion in suboptimal prescribing. This is where, say, 80% of a population has cardiovascular disease, but only 60% are actually taking medications. In terms of Medicaid costs, there was a sea change in some methodology and thinking about medication adherence approximately 3 years ago when the Congressional Budget Office came out with some new methodological research that showed that increased use of prescription drugs leads to lower service use on the health side. In Medicaid, we can see this across populations in terms of blind adults, other adults, and children consistently, that as prescription use increases, service use goes down. What we do know about the CBO methodology is that they're likely understating the effect of improved medication adherence, particularly for certain disease states. For example, those with high cholesterol, savings are potentially three times greater than what the Congressional Budget Office estimates, and you can go across any number of diseases, congestive heart failure, diabetes, and hypertension, all with higher potential savings across the board. But for our exercise and for my organization, we began to say, okay, we know it's a big problem. We know the opportunity is huge in Medicare and Medicaid and other populations. What can we do about it? And we had to first get our arms around why people don't take their medicines. I think you can probably think back on your own experience, perhaps of your parents or your peers. It's a lot of different reasons. People forget. People start taking a drug and they feel better. People, and so they stop. People have side effects on a drug that makes them feel really bad, and so they stop doing that. Sometimes a doctor doesn't prescribe a medication. For those with chronic illnesses, again, these are the people who are more likely than most to take medications. Our survey was a bit shocking to us in that one in four of those with chronic conditions actually opt out of taking their medications without ever telling their healthcare provider. I want to stress that again. The healthcare provider may not even know that the patient with hypertension, diabetes, or some other disease does not even know that the patient stopped taking their medication and that things will get much worse probably for that patient. So after figuring this was a multifaceted solution, we decided we needed a multi-pronged solution to address it. And so we actually asked people in a survey, what would be effective in helping you adhere to your medications? And I think the results of the survey also shocked us in that they said almost anything will help, right? These are big numbers, starting at 63% on research funding and going to well over 90% in terms of the interventions. I would ask you to take a look at the last four bars there where we're at, starting at 87% for medication synchronization. These are essentially tools that provide information either at the point of care or to the provider to help them assist the patient adhere to their medications. The important thing here is that we are sharing decisions and we are providing information so that the patient actually has a stake in their health outcome. So then we spent a few years with all those stakeholder groups figuring out what could we agree on in the policy sense for solutions. And I'll go over three here. There are many more solutions. We can be as creative as you want to be in terms of helping Oregonians reduce their Medicare and other expenses, Medicaid and other expenses. The first is that we need to make it easier for patients to take their medicines. And I want to recognize the great work of the state legislature here. I wish all states were as enlightened and proactive as you. You did great work in making sure medication synchronization was a part of the law here, and I want to thank you, Senator Bates, in particular, for your leadership on that issue. We now need to fund those activities. We need to get prescribers much more engaged with the patients because there are transportation challenges, there are mobility issues for people with Parkinson's, there are a host of issues that synchronizing medications will help address. The second issue here that I would stress is cost sharing. And The ARC at the HHS level has said that cost sharing is a major barrier to medication adherence. I would personally point out that in terms of what we're seeing in commercial health insurance policies is a substantial increase in cost sharing obligations. The silver plans were just mentioned in the last panel, a 20% increase in 2016 just on the deductible for silver plans, and not all individuals are eligible for cost sharing reductions. Those are costs that are borne out of pocket, and so access to care with those types of cost sharing obligations may mean that patients go without.
Senator Steiner, if you don't mind, if I just ask, so this seems to be yet another case where the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. On the one hand, we see an increase in cost sharing for medications, which in theory saves insurance companies money, but probably results in people not taking medications that would actually keep them out of doctor's offices and out of the hospital, which would save probably even more money. Am I hearing you correctly?
You are hearing me absolutely correctly.
Cool. So one of the things I'll look forward to hearing from you is how do we advance this conversation so that we do help the right hand know what the left hand is doing, and figure out ways to quantify how changing the cost sharing requirements and lowering those cost sharing requirements to reduce that barrier could result in substantial cost savings for the commercial insurers as well. Because I think this gets to some extent at what Senator Bates was pointing out about these high deductible plans, about, you know, to some extent what Director Allen alluded to with cost sharing. We need to be thinking about these issues from a policy perspective, and we need to be having robust, thoughtful, not accusatory, but thoughtful conversations with our colleagues in the insurance industry about, and with Medicaid for that matter, but in the insurance, commercial insurance industry in particular, about how can we have constructive conversations and try to quantify, is it really being penny wise and pound foolish to do this much cost sharing?
Madam Chairwoman, Senator Steiner Hayward, I absolutely agree with you. I think what you're hearing from me is that we are not looking at this issue holistically. That we need to, and that there are ways here that we can maybe increase costs on the drug side, lower costs on the health spending side, and come out net negative, right?
Would be my hope.
Yes, Senator Bates.
A couple quick questions here. This is one of the things that drives me personally crazy, and probably Dr. Steiner Hayward too. We have a common prior authorization form in this state that's being ignored by the insurers. If you go back to Prozac, when it first came out, they refused to pay for it, even though it cost them money not to pay for it. Just exactly what she's talking about. The other issue, I don't know if you've asked about, is people getting information off the internet and then stopping their drugs. I get that every single day now. They get this nonsense off the internet, they stop taking their medication, and they come in and congestive heart failure, with the diabetes uncontrolled or hypertension uncontrolled. I'd like to know how to combat that. And then the fourth thing would be, would it be worthwhile and would you support me having a 12-inch ruler I could use across our knuckles sometimes?
Madam Chairwoman and Senator Bates, I think you would be astounded at the breadth of solutions that the market has developed here, from glow caps to sirens to lots of things. So a 12-inch ruler, probably the first time I've heard that. but you might want to market that in the marketplace. I don't know. So I think those are all, again, stresses the fact that this is a multifaceted problem that needs multiple solutions. And so just to move quickly, improved management of medications by clinicians. You have aggressively, again, led the pack here. I would say that with the CCOs, I think a big issue there is integrating some of these care delivery models into those structures and then incentivizing them appropriately. You have these slides, I believe, and I'm happy to go over the information here, but in the interest of time, just to move on to the third one, providing incentives for better outcomes. Again, this fits in squarely with your CCO strategy at the state level. Our organization has submitted comments to the health authorities survey. We have suggested that a key to your strategy is incentivizing providers to do well. Part of that is through using quality measures. So using appropriate quality measures to help transform, that is to pay for people to stay healthy rather than treating them after they get sick. Medication adherence is a core strategy in that regard. We have suggested that you adopt two nationally recognized actionable quality measures. One is related to medication reconciliation post-discharge. A lot of times a patient will be discharged from a hospital. Maybe they were admitted because of a medication issue. They're getting discharged because it's different medications. Their primary care doc may not know that they were even in the hospital, that they're now changed up on different medicines. So within 30 days, we want to know how well people are doing to reconcile those two sites of service. And the second issue, and this is particularly relevant for people with specific conditions, I would suggest mental illness and other types of diseases, is that if they are on persistent treatment over 180 days on a medication therapy, you want to know how many times an intervention has been staged with that individual, and that's NQF 21. Again, these are actionable measures that can be implemented directly into the CCO model that we would recommend. And then finally, I can't stress this enough, that if you are going to pursue the CCO model and rewarding quality improvement through measurement, you have to invest in the infrastructure. So in order to report well and report accurately and to leverage things like EHRs and RIOs and HIEs, that infrastructure has to work well. For that, there are a host of different issues that you need to address, including standard formularies or standard vocabularies, data fields, content, et cetera, which we can get into as well. I encourage you to keep on your track, to improve and focus a little bit more on medication adherence as a real solution to save literally tens of billions of dollars in the state, hundreds of billions of dollars nationwide, while improving health outcomes for patients. Thank you.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Really quickly, first of all, thank you. This is a great presentation, and I completely agree with you on pretty much everything you've said. Second of all, one of the things that occurs to me is that we were supposed to get reverse functionality with the pharmacies, or we're supposed to be getting that. And honestly, if I had the pharmacies pinging me every time my patient filled or didn't fill as expected his or her medication, that would help me a heck of a lot with my doctor hat on. Am I correct, Senator? Because we're supposed to e-prescribe everything, so it's going one direction. But I'm not getting that information back, so I have no idea whether my patient picked up that prescription or not, and if it's a chronic medication, whether they refilled it or not. And it's really tough for me to understand why this can't be a two-way street and feed back into our, and you know, this gets at some of the issues about lot numbers, if there's a recall, it gets at all sorts of health and safety issues that I'd like to know, or if a patient is on warfarin and changes generic brands of warfarin and all of a sudden their INR is out of whack. I kind of like to know if they switched, and the only way I'm going to know is if the patient says, oh, yeah, last month my pills were pink and this month they're green, which happens. I just can't tell, right? I mean, Doc, correct me or add on.
Absolutely.
But this is really...
drives us crazy.
It's a huge issue, and it drives us crazy, and it makes it very tough to figure out, is it something that, you know, if you take the warfarin example, is it something the patient ate differently? Is it... who knows what that they're doing, or is it just that they switch generics? I'm cool with generics. That's not the issue. I just need to understand so that I can make a plan to adjust it.
And Madam Chairwoman and Senator Steiner-Hayward, I think you've put your finger on the issue, which is actionable information, right?
Yeah.
And the two-way street that you're talking about on the pharmacy level, you know, there's a couple of the good thing is that this technology exists. The standards just need to be adopted, and so we have electronic prior authorization standard that CMS should adopt and that should be pushed down to the Medicaid level that would reduce the friction between the pharmacy and the provider office. The other thing I would suggest is that fill status ought to be reported back to the physician office, that you can say, oh, that was the one in five who never picked up the script in the first place, or that was the guy who dropped off and never told me, or... you know, there's something else going on here that prompts a conversation to say, this is having bad side effects, let's switch you to another. Or in the warfarin example, like, I need to figure out what you're eating because you seem to be having X, Y, and Z issues.
Yeah.
So they're actionable information intelligence, but there's solutions there. It comes down to an issue of leadership.
Working on it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming. Great presentation.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about the dental workforce pilot programs, and let's start with Bruce Austin, Linda Mann, and Jennifer Klinemans.
Hello again. I'm Bruce Austin, the statewide dental director in the Oregon Health Authority. And Senator Monis Anderson, Chair Monis Anderson, other members of the committee. I'd first like to give a brief description of the bill that created these pilot projects, and then I'll introduce the two pilot projects and representatives separately. So it's nice to be back here at the table to explain the sequelae of another recent bill and show you the great work we're doing around that. So Senate Bill 738 was passed in 2011, and it allows the OHA to approve dental workforce pilot projects once we approve an application within the OHA. And the goal of the program is to encourage the development of innovative practices in oral health care delivery systems with a focus on providing care to populations that evidence-based studies have shown have the highest disease rates and the least access to dental care. The dental pilot projects are intended to evaluate the quality of care, access, cost, workforce, and efficacy by teaching new skills to existing categories of dental personnel, developing new categories of dental personnel, accelerating the training of existing categories of dental personnel, or teaching new oral health care roles to previously untrained persons. Funding for the pilot project was approved in the 2013 legislature. A project manager was hired, and we opened the application process.
Thank you.
We opened the application process in the spring of last year. Since then, we've reviewed and approved two pilot projects, and I'd like to say we've not only approved them, we're excited about them. And I have representatives from two of those projects here to describe their work to you, and I'll introduce the first project. Oregon is having challenges with the delivery of dental health care. More than 91 areas are designated as dental care health professional shortage areas. One such area is Polk County. And it's there that Capital Dental Care and their partners will implement the pilot project to train expanded practice dental hygienists to place interim therapeutic restorations, or ITRs, within the context of a telehealth-connected dental team. Although the pilot is starting in Polk County, there's an opportunity to have the state consider and approve other pilot sites as well. And I have two guests here today. Linda Mann is an expanded practice dental hygienist and the Director of Community Outreach at Capital Dental Care, Linda to my right. And Dr. Jennifer Klinemans has worked for Capital Dental Care as a general dentist since 2006, focusing on providing care for children, Dr. Klinemans. So I'd like to let them describe their project to you, and then I'll come back and introduce the other project.
Great. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Linda Mann, and I'm the Director of Community Outreach for Capital Dental. And I'm excited to be here. I know you have been waiting a long time to hear about these pilots after approving them a couple of years ago. As Dr. Austin stated, our pilot is training dental hygienists to place interim therapeutic restorations. We are in collaboration with the Central School District in Polk County, the OHSU School of Dentistry, the University of Pacific Center for Special Care, and Capital Dental, where I'm the Director of Community Outreach. Capital Dental has many outreach programs in community settings. We are most excited about our project in Polk County, where we have an expanded practice dental hygienist in the elementary schools. That provides preventive services on site. This dental hygienist is connected via a cloud-based system to Dr. Klinemans, and Dr. Klinemans reviews the information that the expanded practice hygienist collects. She does a dental assessment, she takes x-rays,
She takes intraoral photographs. She does a cleaning, provides sealants, provides fluoride, and then helps to case manage the kids needing care onto a dental office. The exciting addition to this project is the addition of the interim therapeutic restoration. This is another procedure in the toolbox that an expanded practice dental hygienist will be able to implement. Dr. Clemens is going to speak to exactly what an ITR is, and then at the conclusion of her talk, we will be showing just a three-minute video that kind of lets you get a visual of the, what the project is like.
For the record, I'm Jennifer Clemens. I'm a general dentist with Capital Dental Care. An ITR stands for an interim therapeutic restoration. It's a type of filling that is used to stabilize a tooth so that existing cavity doesn't get worse and lead to pain or infection. In the setting where an expanded practice dental hygienist places the ITR, the soft part of the cavity is scooped out with a small dental tool, so there are clean margins, and then the filling material is placed. This is a directed treatment, which means that the dentist determines which teeth needs the ITRs and the treatment plans, and then treatment plans these restorations to be placed by the collaborating hygienist. There's a good deal of training that goes into this project. The dentist will plan the ITR, is trained as to which teeth are good candidates for this treatment by the hygienist. The expanded practice dental hygienist participates in didactic, laboratory, and supervised clinical training. This training includes review of the indications, protocol, and technique for ITR placement. Then there is a supervised placement of these ITR fillings until competency is demonstrated. And then finally, the hygienists are trained as to how to monitor and evaluate the ITRs. After placement, the dentist will review each restoration virtually to ensure it meets clinical standards and determine whether it is an acceptable filling or not. The placing hygienist will evaluate the ITR in person clinically, and twice yearly, the dentist will reevaluate the restoration virtually. Both radiographs and intraoral photos are used to facilitate this evaluation. If at some point it is determined that the ITR doesn't meet our standards, then it would be repaired or replaced, or the patient could be referred to a general dentist for further treatment.
This video is done by Dr. Paul Glassman out of California, and our program closely follows his.
She does it from there.
Okay. Disease has reached epidemic proportions in low-income children and vulnerable adults in California. It's getting worse. 24% of school children have never seen a dentist. Among Latino and African American children, over 50% have experienced dental decay, and almost one-third have untreated cavities. Untreated dental problems are also common in institutionalized elders, disabled adults, and other vulnerable populations. The Pacific Center for Special Care at the University of Pacific Arthur A. Dugoni School of Dentistry has developed a new model to address this problem. It's called the Virtual Dental Home.
The Virtual Dental Home is a new system of care. It's designed to move oral health services into community settings where vulnerable populations live and play and work and go to school and receive social services and general health services. In this system, we have dental hygienists and assistants who are able to be in those community settings, collect records, and post those to internet websites where dentists can actually access the records and establish a collaborative system of care between the dentists in their offices and these community professionals who are working in community settings. Once the dentist has reviewed the records, they'll be able to decide who can be kept healthy in the community and who needs to come into the dental office to have treatment completed. It'll actually be easier to get people into dental offices with this system because the dentist will already be familiar with what kind of work people need to have performed.
Good job.
The beauty of this technology is that I'm able to take photographs and radiographs and any other dental findings on this child. It goes into a secure server, and then the dentist is able to access this information in the privacy of his own office without having to be on location.
This system is terrific because it allows me to evaluate Grace's records without having to be present. After Grace has been examined in the community, those records, x-rays, and photographs can be uploaded to the system. Then I can log on and review those x-rays and photographs from my office. These are Grace's x-rays that were taken while she was in the community. After evaluating these carefully, I noticed there are several areas of concern that are going to require her to come in for dental treatment.
And now, there are a number of things I can do for Grace to keep her mouth healthy in this community setting. I've just applied a fluoride varnish. I can also provide dental sealants and other preventive measures.
The virtual dental home system is being launched across California in places like schools, nursing homes, community clinics, and group homes. This new system of care bridges the gap between community sites and dental offices and clinics. It will keep children, elders, disabled adults, and other low-income vulnerable populations healthy at a lower cost than other systems of care. This system will make a significant difference in the epidemic of dental disease across California.
Do you have any questions?
I'm so excited about this. Oral health is an area that we've not been paying a lot of attention to, and there is such a high need. So hopefully there are going to be more pilots coming forward with innovative ideas like what you're doing. So great. Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you both for a really great presentation. And I completely agree. I'm really excited by this. I was excited when we passed this bill, and look forward to seeing more results. One of the things that I think about a lot with both my policy and my budget hat on is how do we know if we're making a difference in the community, right? I mean, that sounds cool. I get it. There's a kid getting care, you know, in her first grade classroom or kindergarten classroom. I see all the advantages anecdotally. I'd love to know what kinds of outcome measures you're thinking about. What's your baseline for percentage of kids getting regular dental care or cavities or days lost from school or whatever, and how are you going to be tracking those so that we as a legislature, when it comes time to move these things forward, can say, oh yes, this one's getting us a lot of bang for our buck in terms of health outcomes, in terms of saving money. This one, not so much.
Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Steiner, we are tracking everything we can track for this pilot. We are tracking the number of consent forms distributed, the number of consent forms returned, those that are returned, which ones have said yes and which have said no. If they said no, why are they not wanting to participate? The number of kids we're actually treating, the type of treatment that we are doing. The main outcome is the percentage of kids that we are able to keep healthy in the school setting. So that is a key measurement. If in California they've been able to keep 60% of the kids healthy just having their treatment done in the community setting, that means that those 60% of the kids will not need to go into a bricks and mortar dental office to have their preventive treatment done. That thereby opens up access in the dental office for those kids who need the restorative treatment. With the addition of the ITR, we'll be able to also measure how many more of those kids we are able to keep healthy in the community setting. So there hasn't been a lot of data for us to look at from the beginning, so we are collecting everything that we can to be able to measure this and show that it's successful.
Let me please. Those all sound like really good outcome measures. I guess I'm really interested. You know, Dr. Austin made a point that I know have known about before about the number of kids who miss school days because of dental pain, for example. So I'm curious about things like attendance rates. I'm curious about things like just the percentage of kids in general who are getting regular care in a community setting, or if there's an opportunity to get some qualitative data or from families about, you know, this was a barrier because we didn't have gas money to drive the 60 miles to the general dentist or whatever. I guess I think what you're doing, those measures are good. I don't want to add a huge burden on you, but I do want to think about some of the broader outcome measures.
Absolutely. We are surveying the parents, and even on the consent form, we ask if they've had any barriers to care.
Right.
And if you think about it, Polk County's central school district's only 15-20 minutes from Salem. You wouldn't think that kids over there had not been getting care, but that's what we're finding. We're finding the majority of the kindergarten to second graders have not been to a dentist before. That's just next door. Yeah. In Polk County. So we know there are other areas of the state where it's probably a more dire situation. But with the results that we found so far, we anticipate this model spreading.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And now the next pilot, and we'll call up Pam Johnson and Sarah Rogers. Is Kelly Little with him too? Okay.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, and now I'll describe the second pilot project that we've approved. And the purpose of the Tribal Dental Health Aid Therapist Project is to develop a new category of dental personnel in Oregon and teach new oral health care roles to previously untrained individuals. Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board, in collaboration with two tribal pilot sites, will be utilizing the very successful Alaska Dental Health Aid Therapist, or DHAT for short, program that's been providing services in Alaska for the last 11 years. The Alaska DHAP program is modeled off the international model of dental nurses that have been providing oral health services in nearly 100 countries around the world. This modernization of the dental team has put DHATs on the front lines in Alaska, increasing access and improving oral health in previously underserved tribal communities. The sponsors of this Oregon project believe that those outcomes can be replicated in Oregon with the addition of a DHAT to the dental teams at their pilot sites. Now I'll introduce the three people associated with this project. Pam Johnson, here on my right, staffs the Native Dental Therapy Initiative at the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board. Next is Dr. Sarah Rogers. She's the supervising dentist at the Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians Dental Clinic. And Kelly Little, who I met exactly a year ago this week on a tour to Alaska to observe this program, is the Health and Human Services Administrator for the Coquille Indian Tribe Community Health Services.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pam Johnson, and I staff the Native Dental Therapy Initiative at the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board.
We'll help you. That.
Thank you so much for allowing us to share with you.
How often do you floss your teeth?
Oh, I think that video, that second video is played in the background. When you guys ran your video, it said up next preventive video on preventive care or something.
Your teeth.
Sorry, Dan. I think that's what's going on because I saw it run.
That's also what we recommend. So you're doing a great job.
Maybe explore, just, Debbie.
Or just turn, close that last one.
There you go.
There it is. Oh, good.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
Just close that tab. Yeah.
Since it's.
Awesome.
Good diagnostics.
Sorry. Well, I only know it because I saw the video, the thing come up at the end of their video.
Great, thanks. So I want to start today by setting the stage on why we're doing this pilot. And in this first slide, it shows the severity of the oral health disparities in Indian Country. This is from a 2014 IHS survey of preschool kids. And as you can see, for decayed and filled primary teeth of kids 2 to 5, the mean number for American Indian Alaska Native children are 3 times more than white children. And for untreated decay, kids 3 to 5, it's 4 times more decay, untreated decay, than white children. And while this is national data that we're looking at, the Portland area numbers are reflective of these numbers as well. Some of the barriers to care that are resulting in these disparities are shortage and turnover in tribal communities, lack of resources from the Indian Health Services, which is chronically underfunded, cost,
historical trauma of people whose care for decades was somebody coming to their community maybe once and pulling teeth. There's also lack of culturally competent providers. About 0.1 of all dentists are American Indian. And also geographic isolation. One of the solutions to this is looking at a provider called Dental Health Aid Therapist. And over a decade ago, tribes in Alaska were facing similar barriers to care, and so they turned to this new provider model. The model began in the 1920s. It's used in over 50 countries right now. In this model, the dental health aid therapist is under the supervision of a dentist, but it's under general supervision, so they can practice outside of the same building as the dentist. Evidence shows that the care provided by these providers is high quality, cost effective, and safe, and they have a history of providing routine and preventive care in community settings. The DHAT scope of practice is a very small subset of what a dentist does. They do about 46 procedures versus over 500 that a dentist learns. But it does allow them to provide routine, preventive, and restorative care. They attend a rigorous education program where they become experts in these procedures. Upon graduation, they come back to their clinics and they spend another 400 hours with their dentist, with the supervising dentist, before they can practice under general supervision. And then they are recertified every 2 years. The program in Alaska has been a success, and we have no reason to believe that it cannot be replicated effectively here. It's expanded care to Alaska Native, over 45,000 Alaska Natives in the past 10 years. It's provided culturally competent care, high patient satisfaction rates. It's reduced the amount of emergency care. So again, people going to the emergency room instead of their dentist for their care. It's increased preventative care, and it creates jobs and generates economic impact. So we were the first pilot project that was approved here in the state this February, and we are on our way to making this pilot a reality. The goals of our particular pilot here are to expand the access, to grow the number of American Indian and Alaska Native oral health care providers in tribal communities, to bring that culturally competent care into the tribal communities by recruiting members of the tribe to go receive the education and then they come back to their tribe and serve, to create a more efficient and effective oral health team that can meet the needs of the tribal communities, to establish cost-effective solutions, and to bring care where it's needed most. And at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Sarah Rogers, who's the dentist at the Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians Dental Clinic in Coos Bay.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Rogers. I'm going to be the supervising dentist of the first dental health aid therapist in Oregon. I'm really excited. This is just a little bit about the tribes that I'm employed by. They are made up of four bands, two bands of Coos, the Lower Umpqua tribe and the Siuslaw tribe. The thing I didn't know when I started working for them is that they were actually terminated and they managed to fight for, I don't know, what is that? 30 years, and they've got their recognition reinstated in 1984 on October 17th. So they're, you know, this is a people that's very dedicated to taking care of each other and meeting the needs of their tribal members. That's something that I really enjoy about working for this particular tribe. So in the dental clinic, we serve 5-county service area for tribal members as far as our funds for lab work goes. But quite frankly, I have people coming as far from California. I have people driving 3 hours to see me, and I don't believe I'm all that special. Mm-hmm. So there's such a need. That's my biggest thing here is we're swamped and we can't wait for help. So let's go to our next one. Oh, I missed a page. Okay, so what we have done is we've sent myself and the dental hygienist in the office for training in Alaska, so I actually got to see a DHAT practicing. I'm going to go back, I think, again in November and get a week of learning to supervise directly. Our plan is for an experienced dental health aid therapist to be employed late this year or early next year, and so to kind of smooth the way for our tribal member who's in the class right now. I know a big thing that you were asking about before is metrics and data collecting. The consulting company was here, was in our clinic last week, so we talked about what kind of records we're keeping and what we're going to look for. My biggest thing is how long people are waiting to get appointments, and then the amount of teeth or surfaces that are decayed, missing, or filled. But they're even going so far as I think as designing a patient satisfaction survey that's evaluating whether having someone who's a close member of that community and maybe part of their same tribe, how that's meaningful to not only the adults, but they have this, they want to ask the children too, because that's a big push, is to have the children feel comfortable. And then Naomi's in a program. She started summer 2015, and we've got another one who's starting this summer. So next summer, 2017, we should have a member of the CT Clusi tribe working.
Wonderful.
Oh, and there she is.
So she's been shadowing. She came in, you know, she's really excited. I had her chair sighting with me, I think, in December when she was home for Christmas break. I keep telling her, since I've seen their curriculum, I'm a little more pushy now. I'm like, you need to take a break. I told her she was going to stay for 2 weeks, and I'm like, I'll take you for one. I'm like, you can leave whenever you want. But she's really enthusiastic, and it's fun for her friends and family to come in and meet her and talk with her about what she's learning.
Great, Kelly.
Thank you. My name is Kelly Little. I'm the Health and Human Services Administrator for the Coquille Indian Tribe. We're located in Coos Bay, Oregon. We're so the sister tribe to the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Loramqua, and Soyuzla Indians. We, too, cover a 5-county service area, and that is that is the area that the funds that we receive from the Indian Health Service under an Indian Health Service self-governance compact, those funds can be used in that area. And those are to cover Coos, Curry, Jackson, Lane, and Douglas counties. And so that is the Coquille tribal members and their families that reside in those counties. We provide primary health and social services for those members. Additionally, as Dr. Rogers stated, we also provide services to members of federally recognized Indian tribes that are not members of the Coquille Indians, so that could be members from any tribe in the United States. Just as Dr. Rogers stated, we are the only medical, we provide medical care. CT Clusi, Confederate Tribes of Coos, Loramqua, and Soyuzla provides dental care. And we're the only facility, we're the only facility from the California border up into Lincoln County and then east to the Cascades. So we have Indian people come from all over the southwestern corner of the state of Oregon to see us. One of the challenges that we have had with respect to dental care is retention of a provider. We use the Confederate Tribes of the Coos, Loramqua, and Soyuzla Indians for dental care for people who live in Coos County, but they have had many challenges with a provider actually staying within the community. Dr. Rogers has been there for a little over a year.
Mm-hmm. 8 months.
Oh, I thought it was a year, almost. we're a small area, as you know, retention of medical providers, dental providers within these more rural counties is a significant challenge. There have been a few dentists to come in through the doors and out, and access has been a huge challenge. So by engaging and participating in this pilot project, our goal is to first, with the assistance of the Northwest Port and Darien Health Board, is to educate members of the Coquille Indian Tribe. Two Coquille tribal members were just selected to begin the DHAT training in Anchorage, Alaska, with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium starting in July of 2016. And they will conclude their training in July of 2018. So we're very excited. They've just recently been selected, and they will also be joined by a member from the Confederate Tribes of the Coos, Loramqua, and Soyuzla Indians, and Naomi, who will start her second year this year.
Wonderful. Thank you. So great. Any comments? I wish you well. I know that it's going to be very successful, and I'm hopefully that there'll be more.
that will want to be trained. There's a lot of work that needs to be done that's not being, people who are not being served yet.
Well, I should mention that our application is for pilot sites, plural, and these are our first two, and we can add more sites on in different parts of the states and amend our application as we find tribes that are wanting to come on board.
Thank you. Thanks very much. All right. And finally, let's go to step therapy presentation. Emily Boyd.
Hi, Chris. This is Sandy from the Senate Healthcare Committee. I'm going to try and get your volume up so folks can hear you. Okay. Let's.
Better?
Yes.
Yeah, great. Okay.
I think Emily's going to start.
I think Chris is going to start.
Chris is going to start. Okay, Chris.
Yeah, we thought we'd give you the ghostly voice first.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonneff. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, a grassroots membership governed organization composed of people directly affected by mental illness. I'd like to thank you for making this accommodation for allowing me to testify by phone so that I could meet my parental obligations this afternoon. Here, just to kind of foreshadow an issue that we believe is worthy of your future deliberation. I'll touch on it a little bit, and my colleague Emily will probably hopefully have some more specifics because I'm going to talk in some generalities. I'll start with what is step therapy, and step therapy is what we term as a fail-first practice, in that through a formulary process, through your insurance plan, you must start with the least costly medication and must fail on that medication for whatever condition for which you're being treated before you're allowed to access other medications that may be more expensive. With many classes of medications, where medications are generally interchangeable, this approach can work. The issue at NAMI, though, that we confront, however, is that with mental health medications, there is such a high degree of individual response that what is appropriate for one person is totally inappropriate for another. Even though we may share the same symptoms or diagnosis, what works for me may not work for you. We believe that step therapy and how it is being utilized in Oregon is worthy of a broader conversation and eventually deliberation at a legislative level. Currently in our marketplace, we face a myriad of formularies and processes and an ever-changing lineup of approved medications chosen not for their efficacy, but for their low cost. And with cost varying by insurer and by pharmacy benefit managers, meaning that access varies greatly by carrier and can even access among plans with the same carrier. We see this both in the individual marketplace available through the health insurance exchange, and we see this in the group health insurance marketplace, which is typically health insurance sponsored by your employer. For consumers, this means we must spend an inordinate amount of time trying to digest every year during the renewal process what medications are covered, which aren't, and how to navigate a particular insurance plan when the medication I need is no longer covered. We also see difficulties in particular circumstances in which the medication prescribed for a specific patient and for a specific reason isn't available without an unreasonable delay. This is a particular problem with conditions involving psychosis and related disorders, major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, and many other diagnoses and symptoms. And I think it's important for me to note that, in particular, we're not talking about what I would colloquially describe as garden variety mental health conditions. We're talking about people suffering with symptoms that at the time they seek intervention are very disruptive to their lives. So as a patient and a prescriber in those circumstances, you will go through a rather careful evaluation. You're going to look at factors such as symptoms, potential side effects of medications, your individual metabolic responses, and you're going to carefully look in partnership with your prescriber for a medication that is most appropriate. You're going to go to your, fill your prescription at your pharmacy, and through step therapy, it's going to be denied. Now at that point, we will lose some people right there. That seemingly surmountable barrier for some people, particularly suffering with some disruptive symptoms, that's going to be too big of a barrier to overcome. They're going to fall out of our care system until their symptoms get worse, which will require a more intensive response. Some will stick with it, however, and they will be changed to a less costly medication, yet the results for a subset of those people will be the same as those who drop out of the care system, because they will be forced to go weeks and even months failing on one or more medications before being granted access to an appropriate medication. And by that time, their condition is that much harder to treat, and their outcome has grown poorer by that much more. Now, the argument in favor of step therapy is that it controls cost without impacting quality of care, and for many classes of medications, that may be true. But with a specialty class, such as mental health, that isn't true for those who experience crucially disrupting disorders and symptoms. Now, by saying all this, I don't want to leave the impression that we aren't better off today than we were before the expansion of insurance coverage. With expansion, many of us who could not access mental health benefits, or many of us who had insufficient mental health benefits, have much better benefits. And it really is because of that expansion, and because we are trying to do better with people suffering mental health disorders, that we believe step therapy is worthy of your attention in the future. Among our hopes in particular is legislation and rules that will focus really on the quality of care, and that will create a system that has some uniformity from plan to plan and carrier to carrier, that we don't see the great variation that we see today. We have a system that has some predictability, so again, even within the same carrier, we may see multiple approved medications that vary by plan to plan. We would like a clear and easy pathway to override fail-first protocols when clinicians really believe that it's in the best interest of their patients. And we would certainly like to see a reasonable time limit, such as requiring no more than 30 days or even fewer than 30 days, to determine the clinical effectiveness of a medication before an individual may move to other medications. So as I said, that's sort of a foreshadowing of a broader conversation that we hope occurred at the legislative level and among many stakeholders. I'd like again to thank you for your time and for this accommodation, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Why don't we go ahead with Emily, and then we'll see if there are questions.
Great. Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Chairman Anderson and the members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Emily Boyd. I'm the Vice President of Strategic Alliances and Clinical Affairs for the National Psoriasis Foundation. The NPF is located here in Oregon, and we're a nonprofit voluntary health agency dedicated to curing psoriatic disease and improving the lives of those affected. The Psoriasis Foundation is the leading patient advocacy organization for the 7.5 million patients living with the disease, including the almost 100,000 Oregonians living with psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. First and foremost, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity and for taking on an issue that's vital to the health and well-being of those living in Oregon. The legislature truly has an opportunity to be a leader among the states on this issue, and we thank you for the opportunity to be here and for considering potential legislation on this issue. Step therapy is a cost containment tool used by health insurance plans that requires patients to first try and fail on one or more medications not prescribed by their physician before the plan will authorize coverage for the originally prescribed medication. Step therapy impacts a range of chronic and life-threatening diseases, including psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis, multiple sclerosis, diabetes, cancer, mental health, among many others. The use of step therapy is common and still growing among private and public payers. In 2013, 67% of employer-sponsored health insurance plans reported that they had implemented step therapy policies, an increase from 27% in 2005. While insurers and pharmacy benefit managers argue that step therapy protocols provide appropriate and affordable drug treatments, step therapy can have the opposite effect by unnecessarily prolonging ineffective treatment and preventing patients from immediately starting treatments recommended by their physician or healthcare provider. It also quite frequently ignores the diverse treatment options available to treat in a chronic disease like psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. A psoriatic disease patient's journey may look something like this. John Smith is currently on a biologic and seeing total clearance on that drug. He's stable and he gets a new job. At his new job, he checks the formulary for the new plan and finds out the medication is covered. He goes to get his injection prescription and is denied the prescription and asked to try a topical. He appeals and is told the process could last up to 90 days. During this period, he experiences washout on his drug and he has a flare. He's now covered over 30% of his body.
The topical is not working, and he's out of luck. The exception process must be non-burdensome on the patient and medical professionals. Over the past few years, several states have addressed step therapy through either legislation or regulatory action. 11 states currently have protections that are codified or go into effect by the end of the year, and over a dozen states are currently considering legislation. None of the laws that have passed ban step therapy. Instead, they focus on ensuring that a clear pathway exists for an exception to step therapy being granted by an insurer. The intent of this legislation is to provide a means for patients to get the medication that is best for their unique medical condition, which will lead to increased drug regimen adherence, which creates a healthier patient population, which in turn drives down costs. We respectfully encourage the legislature to consider crafting legislation that would require health plans to provide a clear and timely process for prescribers to request an exception to a state therapy protocol where it is medically necessary. Ensure that step therapy protocols developed by insurers are based on nationally recognized clinical practice guidelines. Give physicians the ability to immediately override the step therapy protocol in the following instances. The required prescription drug is contraindicated or will likely cause an adverse reaction by physical or mental harm to the patient. The required prescription drug is expected to be ineffective based on the known relevant physical or mental characteristics of the patient and the known characteristics of the prescription drug regimen. The patient has tried the required prescription drug while under their current or a previous health insurance or health benefit plan, or another prescription drug in the same pharmacologic class or with the same mechanism of action, and such prescription drug was discontinued due to lack of efficacy or effectiveness, diminished effect, or an adverse event. The required prescription drug is not in the best interest of the patient based on medical appropriateness. The patient is stable on a prescription drug selected by their healthcare provider for their medical condition under consideration. The direct and indirect cost of step therapy. Step therapy is touted as a tool to reduce costs to insurers, but it may simply trade prescription costs for significant time costs to patients, providers, and pharmacists. According to one study, 28% of patients who had encountered a step therapy edit reported spending 3 or more hours trying to obtain second-line drugs from their physician's offices. Step therapy also increases the administrative burden of medical providers. Physicians and their staff must spend time contacting insurance companies to determine if a drug will be covered, in addition to appealing denied treatments, which leaves less time for patient-centered healthcare. By some estimates, this increased administrative burden takes approximately 2 hours per patient. The time and administrative burden associated with step therapy presents an obstacle to access that may lead to unnecessary breaks in treatment. Indeed, several studies have found out, depending on therapeutic class, that 7 to 22% of patients did not submit any prescription claim to their insurance providers following a step therapy edit, instead foregoing treatment. While proponents of step therapy tout its cost savings benefits, there are examples of cases where, in fact, step therapy increased costs over time. In a study comparing spending on schizophrenia medications in Georgia's Medicaid program, step therapy saved the state $19.62 per month, per member per month in a pharmacy benefits, but these savings were accompanied by a $31.59 member per month in increase in expenditures for outpatient costs. Thank you so much for this time. We're, but Chris and I are both open for questions.
Senator Steiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I absolutely believe this stuff happens, right? I get it. That being said, I will say that I am on a very expensive third-line drug for my MS, right? I'm on a biologic, been on it for 9 years now. In that period of time, I've changed insurances at least 4 times, right?
Right.
Two different employers, at least 4 different insurance plans, and not once have I had to do anything to have my medication continued.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm wondering is, what's Oregon's situation really look like? I'm sure you're hearing about it. So I'd love some sense, and I know it's hard to get these numbers, right? I get that. And Chris, maybe you can provide other stuff as well, or others can. I'd love to have some sense of the scope of the problem and whether it's certain commercial insurers that are being more problematic, creating more problems from this than other commercial insurers, so that we can start to think about this in a more nuanced way, because I think there's more to this story. I don't disagree with you. This stuff happens. But I'd love to know a little bit more about how often and when and what populations.
I mean, I can, and Chris, feel free to chime in. I can speak for psoriatic disease. It's very common. And I can, we can provide you specific organ numbers. It's not necessarily payer specific. I mean, we've done studies. We do work with our payers to try to figure out, you know, where exactly the issue is. A lot of times it's location based as much as it is payer based. So we see this as quite an issue, not necessarily some of the older biologic treatments, but a lot of the newer biologic treatments as well are harder to access. And typically you have to fail on one of the older biologics or even methotrexate before getting approval for one of the newer ones. And as we've seen with some of the newer biologics coming out that have in clinical trials and even in practice almost 100% efficacy and clearance, you know, that's what the patient population is looking for. And when they have to first try another drug where they may not get that total clearance, that seems to be more of an issue as well in order to get approval for some of those newer biologics.
Thank you.
If you can get some of that information.
Absolutely.
Send it to Sandy.
Sure.
And she can get it to the rest of the committee.
Great.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Chair Mona Anderson, yes. If I may.
Yes, please.
The question is a good one. Some of the data are lacking, and certainly we admit to that. The asking, you know, an organization like NAMI to what degree it happens is hard for us to say. In this sense, is when things go well and your health, as you describe your health insurance plan, you've had changes that have gone very well. We don't see that. I mean, people come to NAMI because they are struggling and can't get somewhere, and I think regardless, though, of the data, what an organization like mine would like to see is some predictability and uniformity, so that when we do encounter these things, there is a pathway to address them. And right now, there's such a high degree of variability from carrier to carrier and plan to plan that it becomes very, very difficult to navigate that either as a family or individual, or even as an advocacy organization whose role is to assist those individuals. And as we've seen, you know, solutions in other states pop up, really it helps an organization like mine and our population. And just having something that's predictable down on paper and digestible to be able to navigate this issue.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you guys very much.
Senator Bates.
Senator Bates.
Just real quickly, the questions that the senator asked are germane, the ones we need answered, because anecdotal information is questionable. But I can speak for a group of 60 primary care physicians. This has, in the last 5 years, become an absolute nightmare.
Yes.
And it's not just in psychotropic drugs, which we've already fought this battle for 20 years. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Cruz. I don't want to hear about it anymore. I mean, we're not going to do step therapy and psychotropic drugs. I don't believe in this body. The other drugs are just the same problem. You don't know what they want. The drug that was prior off before is now the, you know, drug they like.
Right.
And I'm talking about generic drugs. They just cut different deals every 6 months. We have four people we've hired just to do prior offs. It's 2 or 3 hours for each one of them. And ultimately, we sometimes just give up and send the prescription to Canada, or we write a check for it and have them go buy it at the local pharmacy because it isn't worth the trouble doing it anymore. And the insurance company, of course, loves that because they're collecting the premium, but they're not paying the price. This thing has gotten completely and totally out of control. And you'll hear most about biologicals, and you'll hear most about oncology drugs and probably hep C drugs, but it's across the board now.
Absolutely.
And it's driving us nuts. The insurance companies also have refused to use the prior authorization form, which this state passed. It's the law of the land, and they refuse to follow that law. We're going to have a meeting with DCPS on Wednesday about this. I don't know if it's going to take a suit against them or what it is. This whole thing's gotten completely out of hand. It's driving us crazy, and it's driving the patients crazy.
Absolutely.
And I'm now starting to write prescriptions for Canada again. And we thought we were past all that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. For chronics like Hep C, you're kidding.
Not Hep C yet. We can't get it out of Canada, but Crestor, some hypertensive drugs, for a while doxycycline, which we should be $10 a day, $10 a month, went to $250. So I wrote a prescription and got 1,000 capsules down. We dispensed it at our site. I mean, it's gotten crazy.
Yeah.
It's just it just has to be brought under control. insurers need to recognize that and start working with us. We've offered a couple of suggestions to them. One, you have a common uniform method across the state for everyone, so you always have the same knowledge about it. You can only change it once a year. When it changes for one, it changes for all, because we deal with 40 or 50 companies. And I talked to Regents Blue Cross one time about if a physician is writing 85% generic, why not give them, you know, the gold star, and they can make their own decisions about the patients? Because there is some physicians who only write branded products all the time when they don't need to. So there are those issues in there, but there's ways around this. The insurers have got to step up and work with us.
Absolutely, and you know, the drop-off that we see in patient adherence because they don't want to go through this similar process too. So, you know, what we see from our patient population is that almost 70% of patients are undertreated or untreated because they're left with a topical, or they just don't want to deal with the hassle of going from drug to drug. So thank you for that, Senator Bates.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this concludes the informational hearing. I believe we have covered everything. We're adjourned.